as we've already discussed, I have my paneled setup of windows, and the one.
Where does that accent come from? It's not a Connecticut thing.
I wasn't aware I had one.
The word for the thing you cook in, and the first syllable for your arrangement of windows, panel versus pan.
Panel.
Right.
How do you pronounce it?
Not the same way as the thing that you cook in.
Well, he says panel.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, what do you cook in?
A pan.
Oh.
Not a pan?
So, wait, so I'm...
You say them both the same. You say, I cook in a pan, and I have a bunch of panels.
Yeah, so how would you say it?
I cook in a pan, I have a bunch of panels.
That sounded the exact... Are you trolling me right now? That sounded exactly the same.
Analyze the waveforms. Pan, panels, pan, panels. Marco, you said, what do you have going on over there?
I cook in a pan.
Yeah.
And I have panels.
Interesting middle ground.
They're slightly different from each other.
I don't understand. Am I hammered? What is happening? I can't hear the difference. What is going on right now? Is this what being colorblind feels like? What the hell is happening? All right, so we talked a lot last week about onboarding screens and why they're there, what is their purpose, whether they're good, whether they're bad, etc. And I was informed that the reason that these screens are happening is because of GDPR, which I know almost nothing about. And I've been a little busy, and so I'm a poor chief summarizer in chief, but nevertheless... GDPR is a General Data Protection Regulation, which is something that the EU passed recently and has come into effect or is coming into effect very, very, very soon. Oh, it becomes enforceable from the 25th of May, 2018. So we are coming up on it now. I guess this doesn't apply to Britain too soon. Anyway, the point is, apparently it talks about how companies store your data and tries to give you more control of your data. And I've been told that that is the genesis of all of these onboarding screens.
I'm not sure if I buy that, because I bet that screen is going to be everywhere, not just in Europe. And it's not like Apple is above doing region-specific UIs. I do a bunch of stuff that I think is only visible in China, for instance.
Interesting. Maybe, yeah.
On the other hand, I feel like this GDPR thing, which I'm basically just learning about now because I didn't actually follow your link in the show notes, reminds me of the European cookie regulation stuff. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
You have to remember, I think it's still in effect. Like, if you go to, they got to throw up a pop-up that says, just so you know, this website is going to, you know, use cookies to keep track of you, agree or disagree, right? It's another example of properly motivated but ill-conceived legislation, where the motivation is pure. Like, there's these computers, and they potentially could be storing us personal information and tracking us, which, by the way, they totally do. Let's do something with the law to deal with that. But this... the impulse to do this comes really early on in the history of the web, when the scariest thing out there is a cookie, right? And the legislation is, I know, let's make every website in the world annoying forever. And let's never do anything else related to other kinds of tracking that'll be much, much worse than cookies. And, you know, like so many other laws, like it just sits there until someone, you know, who's going to have the motivation to say, you know what, we should stop doing that because it's dumb. Or, like, we should realize the folly of this particular technique of trying to get people to grapple with privacy. Because if you say this is the way we should deal with everything, then you got to have stuff like that for all forms of JavaScript, every kind of local storage, all the flash-based super cookie whatever thing. It never ends. And, you know, you'd have to plow through 50 layers of click wrap, as they call it, to get to the website that you want. If there's some new kind of legislation that says, by the way, every time you launch an application, you got to throw a thing in someone's face, which I don't think that's what this GDPR thing says. But if there were such a thing, I think that would be sort of the modern equivalent of the cookie legislation, motivated by a noble intent, but ill-conceived, badly implemented, and sure to age badly. So we'll see. Maybe when these things roll out, and Apple talks about them on stage, maybe they will make a pitch in that direction. But as far as I can tell, it looks a lot more like what we talked about last show, a way for Apple to advertise one of its competitive advantages and to provide some reassurance and to explain what the applications do in a more clear way than just showing an empty list view.
Yeah, we'll see. But supposedly that is kind of the genesis for this. There's also going to be a link in the show notes. Smashing Magazine has How GDPR Will Change the Way You Develop, which talks about, you know, kind of how all this will affect developers. And the rumblings I've heard through various sources is that this is a bigger deal than any of us Americans are realizing, because it doesn't seem to apply to us, but it applies to any of us that have, you know, code that reaches more than one country and more than just America. So,
and by the way, I think it is possible to make good legislation to protect consumers' privacy. It's just really hard to do when it comes to tech, because the tendency is to pick whatever the specifics of the technology are at the moment and attack them and demonize them, when really it's a much more general concern. And historically speaking, legislative bodies have not had a good track record with legislating technology, essentially, like understanding what the underlying issue is rather than attacking a specific technology as the one and only vehicle through which this issue will manifest. And that's never true. Like, maybe that, you know, cookies were how privacy manifested a long, long time ago. Privacy issues manifest in the following decades in so many more important ways than cookies. And yet the legislation just sits there staring at cookies, which is why you can't really legislate to technical details. You have to figure out what it is that we're really concerned about and make a law such that it applies in a useful way to any future technology, but also at the same time doesn't preclude future technologies that may run afoul of the letter of the law, if not the spirit. Making laws is hard. Making laws about technology is doubly hard. One way to help with this, by the way, I'm saying this mostly from a U.S. perspective, I have no idea this is done in Europe, is perhaps take the advice and consultation of people who know things about technology who don't have a vested interest in one way or the other. Like, kind of like talking to mathematicians and cryptographic experts when you make any laws related to cryptography, which the U.S. seems completely incapable of doing, or they talk to them and ignore what they say. And said, I think I'll listen to industry lobbying groups instead.
They have all the money, so they must know what they're talking about.
I mean, to be fair, like, we can't even agree that facts are facts.
I know. I'm thinking back to a more naive time when we could simply complain about how technologically illiterate our legislative bodies are. Now we have much more pressing concerns.
And now I'm sad. Thanks for that, John. All right. Last week we talked about how if you are a member of one or 30 Slack teams, you can actually, a little known fact, you can access Slack via IRC. I don't know when this announcement actually happened, but as it turns out, we got word within moments of releasing the episode that that's going away now. So it has been disabled for Slack teams that haven't enabled it, and I think it will be phased out in the next some duration of time. So, whoops.
I'm not surprised by this, because
me neither.
It totally seems like a thing that Slack might do early on. As part of it, let's make sure you have no excuse not to use Slack, right? And then as Slack becomes more successful, and as they can compare the statistics of how many people use our IRC gateway versus how much does it take to maintain it versus how much does it help our, you know, strategic intent of the company, it's probably used by a vanishingly small percentage of Slack's customers. They no longer are in that mode where they need to convince people to use Slack, because the ball has started rolling, and it probably does take some amount to maintain, and it's just a distraction, so it kind of makes sense that it goes away. But I bet if you use it, you're probably pretty annoyed by that.
Indeed. So that happened coincidentally right around the time we were bringing up on the show that, hey, you can do this too. Moving on. Amazon's Alexa is gaining a new follow-up mode, which no longer requires a trigger word after every request. So what will happen is Alexa will listen for 5 seconds after your previous request to see if you're wanting to ask another question. The blue ring on your Echo will remain lit, and it will indicate that she is still listening. In this time period, you can ask her another question. Otherwise, she'll go back to sleep mode. That's cool.
See, this to me, it sounds cool until you actually think about how that works in practice. And I think you can actually enable it now. But the problem with that is it's not addressing what you actually want, which is what you actually want is to say, Cylinder, play El Scorcho by Weezer and turn the volume to 5. You know, like, you want to be able to do multiple commands in one sentence or in one command. And they can't do that right now. None of them can, as far as I know. And that's what you actually want. What this feature does is, hey, Cylinder, play El Scorcho by Weezer. And then it says, okay. And then it starts playing. Like, you don't want that. Like, that is not what
I don't think it's stopping on the command. I think all it's doing is, I mean, it, from my reading of this article, is all it's doing is it will immediately start playing the song that you asked for, but for the next 5 seconds, anything else you say, it will try to interpret as a command as if you had prefixed it with "Hey, Cylinder."
Right, but then, like, I'm pretty sure then the volume still stays ducked, and it's just like, I feel like the percentage of the time that's going to actually do what you want versus the percentage of the time that it's going to either keep listening to something you say afterwards that you didn't intend for it to be a command, or just delay what you were trying to do, or do something, or, like, you thought it was still listening, gave it another command, but the 5 seconds had just ended. Like, I feel like the failure rate of that to do what people actually want is going to be way, way too high to be acceptable. Like, it's just, it's not going to be good enough of the time. Whereas what, like, and it's also, like, to me, that's not smart. That's just like a very small implementation detail. That's not actually making the service smarter. What we actually need is for all of these voice assistants to become smarter and to recognize compound commands. That's what people actually want. Play El Scorcher by Weezer and turn the volume to 5. Set a rice timer for 10 minutes and a pasta timer for 7 minutes. This is what people actually want to do. And so, you know, little tricks like this, like, that's a dumb hack. Really, what we need is for the voice assistant to get better, to actually recognize multiple commands the way humans will actually give them.
So this is also not what I was asking for last week. I think that's why it was sent to us as follow-up. What I was asking for was context awareness, such that follow-up commands could be aware of what you asked for previously and interpret your subsequent commands in light of what you had just asked it, based on, like the way a person would. If you say something to a person and then an hour later you say something else, there's no way they're going to connect that to the context of the last thing you said to them. But if you say something to them and then add an addendum 2 seconds later, they have the context of the first command, you know, to understand what you mean. And the key part of that is that the second thing that you say is not itself a complete command. It relies on the knowledge of the context. That's why I said last week that it probably requires some more local hardware, because you would want, I mean, at least for privacy reasons or whatever, you'd want some of that local context awareness to happen, you know, locally. You don't need the server to keep track of, like, your session or whatever, so it can understand that. I think you could keep some of that locally. Compound commands would also be good, and actually seem much easier to me than what I'm asking for, because, like, it's two commands and there's a joiner and you can figure it out and break it up into pieces. But I think it's more natural to have a conversation to hone in on what you want, because that's what you do with other people, than to formulate even a single command, let alone a compound command, as if, as I said a couple weeks ago, you're playing a verbal text adventure where maybe you don't have to get the syntax just right, but you understand that you're issuing a command, and now you can issue compound commands. But it's not the way you would yell into the other room for Marco to add something to your shopping list. You don't have to formulate a command for Marco. You can basically say it in any way that you want, including addendums and revisions and, you know what, never mind about that, just get the other thing. Like, you can say stuff like that, and it knows what the heck you're talking about. And the Cylinder does not. And that is a really tall order. Delay mode or follow-up mode or whatever is not close to that, but it at least shows the next, it at least shows that they understand that the current mode of wake word or wake phrase followed by single command followed by I forget you exist is pretty primitive.
Also, like, I feel like this kind of has like a Simon Says problem, where, like, if you get accustomed to not saying the wake word before every command you give, that doesn't work all the time. Like, you can't say, Cylinder, play El Scorcher by Weezer, and then 10 seconds later say, Volume 5, because it won't recognize it.
Yeah, you have to say Simon Says Volume 5.
You got to say Cylinder Volume 5. Right, and it's like, but sometimes you don't have to say that. Like, so if you say it within 5 seconds of the previous command being completed, then you can omit the word Cylinder, and it's like, well, that's going to be confusing. Like, it's going to trip you up when you're, like, it's going to increase your error rate. Like, this is just one of the reasons why this isn't a solution. I feel like at a high level, I think what kind of makes me sad about the voice assistant market is that all of us, like, Apple fans are accustomed to somebody being, you know, historically Apple, being really good at designing really smart software and really good software experiences. And the rest of the industry has always been pretty crappy overall. Like, there's been a couple of bright spots here or there, but not many. And I feel like we're all having to use, like, the, like, Amazon and Google stuff. And Amazon and Google have always been pretty rough, especially Amazon, pretty rough at user interaction design and software usability design. And what we're seeing here is just like, you know, tech companies making stuff that's mediocre, which is what we've always seen. And Apple was always the one who could save us from that. But unfortunately, in this particular market, they just seem not capable of that for whatever reason. And that just makes me sad. Like, because it's like usually Apple would be the ones to save us and to make like the really good thing for people like us who cared about good experiences and all the details and everything. And in voice assistants, they just aren't capable of doing that for whatever reason. And it's kind of sad.
I continue to think that this is much more in Google's wheelhouse than Apple's, because yes, it's a part of user interface design, but specifically this realm of translating words that a human comes up with into an intent is what the Google search box is all about. It frustrates some of us because it no longer works like AltaVista, where you can formulate like a Boolean query with exact substring matching and get predictable results. But that Google search box is all about saying people just type lots of stuff there, and you can type things there, and I'm still amazed at the Google search box. I type things there, and it finds what I meant for it to find, and I don't even know how it's doing it. Like, how did you get what I was trying? You know, you go to the page or whatever, and like, none of those words are on this page. Like, you somehow figured out what I meant. Granted, it's still a single command and response, and it's not a conversation, but Google was founded on that strength of going beyond the sort of simple direct computer search to intelligent interpretation of human-generated words and translating that to an intent and satisfying the request, despite spelling errors, weird phrasing, the foibles of humans, right? And the verbal one of that, now that speech-to-text is as good as it is, it maps very well onto the search problem, in that you have to figure out intent, and you can get the words from it pretty well, and then you have to figure out intent. And same thing with spelling errors, same thing with homonyms or whatever, that Google's good at figuring that out. That's always been Google's strength, so I totally look to them to be the ones to figure out this aspect of user interface before Apple, and I think they are doing it better than Apple. But I agree that all of them are not as good as I could hope. Like, Apple's way behind, and Amazon and Google have been ahead, but I'm waiting for them both to take like the next small step.
We are sponsored this week by Backblaze. Go to backblaze.com/ATP for a fully featured 15-day free trial. Start backing up your data. Backblaze offers you unlimited cloud backup for your Macs and PCs for just $5 a month per computer. Backblaze backs up documents, music, photos, videos, drawings, projects, everything. And you can access all of your data anywhere in the world, on the website or on the go using your phone. And you can restore as much as you want. You can restore your entire drive if you want to, if you have a major data loss. Or if you're, say, on a trip and you just need access to a file that you forgot to bring with you, you can restore just one file, once again, on the website or on their apps for mobile phones. It's your choice. You can also restore by mail. So, for instance, if you have a whole bunch of files or like a whole drive to restore, and it's going to take an unreasonable amount of time to download all that stuff, you can buy a hard drive with all your data on it that gets overnighted to you via FedEx. And if you return the drive back to them when you're done, you get a refund. Backblaze is used by tons of people. They have over 500 petabytes of data under management, including about, 10 terabytes or so of data from my house. It's wonderful. I've used them for a long time, since before they were a sponsor of any of my stuff. And I'll tell you what, Backblaze is the best. They really are. If you want online backup, trust me on that. And if you're going to get online backup, I've tried a lot of services, and I stick with Backblaze for lots of good reasons. I highly suggest use Backblaze. Backblaze is gimmick-free. There's no additional charges. Just $5 a month for full backups. Unlimited space, no upload throttling or anything like that. You can upload as fast as your connection will do it. And of course, you have control of that if you want to. It's wonderful. Go to backblaze.com/ATP to see for yourself and start a 15-day fully featured free trial. Go there, play with it, start protecting yourself from all the risks that can happen if you don't have your data backed up in the cloud. And they also have now business backup. So if you already have Backblaze at home, tell your system at work, or if you are the system at work, tell yourself to go to backblaze.com/ATP and hit the business backup link in the top of the page. The same awesome service with more admin tools using Backblaze groups. See for yourself, once again, 15-day free trial at backblaze.com/ATP. Start backing up your data right now. Trust me, you will not regret it. Thank you so much to Backblaze for sponsoring our show.
Well, did you guys see there was some sort of like drama about Siri that happened today? I did not get a chance to look up what happened, but apparently someone was like, oh, Siri's garbage and it's not my fault. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know. It's a story on The Information, which when I see that website, I always think of Marco, and I'm like, there's someone,
the website.
It's much worse. It's much worse than the magazine ever was, because The Information is like, anyway.
You know, The Information is really spammy. I really don't like, they signed me up to their mailing list when they launched as if I had signed up saying I was interested. Mm-hmm. And as a result, even though I have never responded to anything, never signed up for anything, they still incessantly spam me. And I really I know it's kind of low to call them out publicly for this, but that is not okay for anybody to do. It just drives me nuts.
You can unsubscribe. I just unsubscribed today, speaking of them.
I did, because it finally drove me that nuts. But I'm just like I never signed up for this, and all you're doing is promoting articles that I can't see because I'm not going to pay $40 a month to a spammer. And so, it drives me nuts. I just, people play fast and loose with mailing lists all the time. And the mailing list companies, like MailChimp and everything, they're all complicit in this because they don't require a double opt-in when you import a mailing list from another service, allegedly. And so, they're all complicit because they all make spamming people in mass really easy. And as a result, I get on all sorts of spam lists that appear like I signed up for them. And, it's a dirty, scammy trick when you're launching something like this to use, a PR list you find somewhere or you buy somewhere. And The Information was one of the companies that does this, one of the many companies that does this. And so I just have zero respect for them. Zero. And I know it's a dumb reason, but that's how nuts this drives me.
Well, anyway, this explains why none of us actually read the article, because none of us have paid for The Information. But we know about it because they're good at spamming people and letting them know this article exists. It was, I think, summarized on 9to5 Mac, which is also kind of a scummy practice of taking a paywalled article and then basically rewriting it worse on your site so that people read your site instead of the paywalled thing.
Yeah, I love this business. It's such a great business. I should really go back to publishing web content. That sounds like a lot of fun.
I mean, I can understand a paragraph and a link seems reasonable, but once you've gone on for a page and a half laboriously summarizing an article that you didn't write. Anyway, the story, as far as I could tell, was a bunch of reports from people inside Apple or ex-Apple people who know about the internal workings of Siri over the years, saying how and where things went wrong, with specific quotes from specific people assigning blame to other people, not to themselves, explaining the situation. And it's just the typical, things aren't going great inside a big company, product launches and it's not scalable and it's band-aided and everyone points fingers about who set the priorities or what they should be doing and how often it should be updated. I mean, it's mostly details that may be interesting, or from a business case perspective, if you're learning about how businesses run, interesting. But practically speaking, I care less and less about the internal political goings on in Apple and mostly just say that's Apple's job to figure out. I'm not running Apple. I'm not an executive there. I'm not a high level manager. That's their job as a company to figure out how to corral the people to produce results. And if it doesn't go well, I'm not that interested in why it didn't go well, who was to blame, which person was more difficult, which person made the big wrong strategic decision at what point. They just need to figure that out. But on the outside, I just say, look, how's the product doing? And the product, as we've discussed in the past, not doing that great. And they've had a long time, so I hope they get it sorted out.
I don't even want to get angry about Siri again. So let's just move on. And instead, let's get angry about keyboards. Marco, this is your cue. Apple apparently has patented a keyboard that cannot be defeated by crumbs. Marco, I know you have been celebrating. You are swinging from the rafters. You're so excited. So I don't know when we're going to expect to see this, but hopefully it will mean that I don't need to invest in compressed air anymore.
I mean, this is a problem I don't have because I have a laptop that has a functioning keyboard.
That's true. I walked right into that one.
But why do you think Marco would be excited by this? This seems like Marco's nightmare to me, because Marco loves the fact that the keyboard he hates also has a terrible reliability problem that allows him to righteously rail against it. Imagine if they made that keyboard 100% reliable. Then all he's got is, this keyboard works all the time, but I hate it.
I mean, to be fair, when it first came out, before we knew how badly it would break all the time, that is what I did. And and also, the arrow key placement is still horrendous. Not having the gap above the arrows is above the left and right is unforgivable. But anyway, look, I'm of two minds of this. Number one, John's right. I In a way, I don't want to see this keyboard succeed and be fixed. I'm not going to lie. That is part of my motivation because I don't like it so much. But also, like, keep in mind I had those keyboards for, what, about a year before I finally gave up?
Across 13 different laptops.
Three. So I had the keyboard, and it's like I got used to it enough. Like, I never liked it, but I was able to function with it until it stopped working reliably. So the reality is, I got to choose my battles here. I know that a lot of people out there don't care or even like this keyboard. I know that that Apple is always going to press to make these things thinner. And I think Apple has shown it across multiple years and multiple products that they only care about making the keyboard thinner, and they will make some efforts to make the thin keyboard tolerable, but that they are no longer interested in keeping it a good keyboard if that means they can't make it thinner. And so I just have to kind of resign myself to accept that. I'm not going to rail on this for a half hour like I usually do, because I fought this battle. I lost this battle. And I'm going to continue to lose this battle into the future. The last thing I think Apple's going to do in the next MacBook revision is to make the keyboard thicker. It's just not going to happen. And I fundamentally don't believe that they can make a keyboard with this little travel good. I just don't think they can do it.
Good as far as you're concerned, though, because lots of people do really like the keyboard. I mean, Casey and I included have basically been converted to this new keyboard. Mm-hmm. It's just the reliability issues and, as you said, the key layout.
Right. And so basically, if they can fix the reliability problems, yeah, I would love if they made the keyboard a different style. But if they can fix the reliability problems, that's the best I can hope for.
The key layout is just sitting right there, too, because there can be divisive opinions about do you like how this keyboard feels or not. Like, some people like it, some people don't. Fine. But I feel like key layout changes, there are certain key layout changes that would be universally praised from the perspective of using the keyboard, and the only naysayers would be aesthetic. For example, inverted T, full size, breaking the rectangle of the keyboard. Aesthetically, people would hate that. It would be like the notch on the keyboard. It would be like an asymmetrical notch on the bottom of your keyboard, and those people would yell about it. But from the perspective of people who type, how does it feel to type on? I don't see anybody saying, please bring back the half-size arrow keys, with or without the gaps above them. I mean, are there fans out there who would say, please bring them back? Again, people, yes, from an aesthetic right perspective, here, I can imagine it, but not from a functional perspective. Did you just say that you would ask to bring back the half arrow keys?
You mean the way I have them on my 2015, where the left and right are half height?
No, I mean make full height and have the rectangular shape that the keyboard defines be broken.
So basically have the up key in line with the other ones now, but have the down, left, and right in their own row below it?
Yes, exactly, and have all of them be full-sized and have gaps above them.
I mean, that would be cool, but they're never going to do that. So
I know, I'm just saying, like there are key layout changes that I think would be universally praised from a functional perspective, but derided only from an aesthetic perspective. And I'm not even saying they're wrong, because I understand thinking that's ugly. But boy, would that be nicer for people who use arrow keys a lot.
Which is, I think, everybody. Like, who doesn't use the arrow keys a lot? Like,
my son, oh God, when he's taking those online those online coding
the
courses
kids these days.
And he's using the mouse to move his insertion point one space. I'm just like, use the arrow keys. Use them. Like, stop. He goes from the keyboard to the mouse to the keyboard to the mouse.
He can't reach them. He can't figure out where they are because they're all the same height as everything else.
Oh, no, he's using a full-size Apple extended keyboard with full-size arrow. Are you kidding? We're not using... This is on...
not my house.
We're using real keyboards here. And, like, I even showed him the modifier for moving a word at a time and beginning of end of line, but just for single characters. Like, seeing him take the mouse and steer it to go to the left of, you know, the place where he needs to insert a quotation mark to match the other one. It's like, just hit the left arrow once. I swear to you, it will work. And he's just not. He's not on that page. This is what happens from not using computers and only using, like, iPads and iPhones, like, your whole formative years. You have no idea about moving the cursor with arrow keys.
Well, anyway, I wouldn't expect Apple to do anything that's going to make the keyboard less attractive to the current Apple design team's aesthetic.
I agree, unfortunately.
They're just not going to do it. Like, you know, this is not like a rare thing with Apple these days. Like, look at the Apple TV remote. Look at their regular, like, keyboards and mice and everything. Like, if they were willing to make it a little bit ugly, they could make it better ergonomically or feel better or work better or whatever else, but they're not. And it's easy to see both sides of this argument. Like, we all argue, like, these things should work better. Design is how it works. They argue we are printing money, and this is how we like to design things, and this is what looks good. And people buy our stuff in part because it looks good.
And it is aesthetically better. I think we would all agree it does look better when the keyboard is just a rectangle. Like, it just does. Like, as a piece of art, as a, you know, but...
Yeah. And look, Apple these days is really good at designing beautiful things that kind of suck to use. Like, that's kind of what they're best at, right? Like,
it could even be argued that the uniformity is the reason the right and left arrow keys became full height, because those little gaps were an asymmetry.
I guarantee you that's the reason. Because there's no other reason to do it. It doesn't make them easier to use.
The same reason that the bottom row of keys is now the same height as all the other rows. Again, uniformity.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. It's, you know, because it's designed purely to aesthetics. It's egotistical design. It is indulgent design for the designers to indulge themselves in what they think looks the best without regard to how things work.
Someone, I think, also pointed out that even on the external keyboards for desktop computers, the bottom row of keys is now the same height as all the other ones. I didn't actually check this because I don't have one of those new keyboards to compare with, but I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case, if only for part sharing reasons, because you all know how Apple likes to use the same keyboard across all of its laptops from 12 inches to 17, which I will, you know, forever remember as a ridiculous thing. And now it is only slightly less ridiculous. It's shared between the 15 and the 13 and the 12, I guess. So on this, before we leave this bit of follow-up here on this patent, the date of this patent is 2016, which makes me think, like, just as the original MacBooks were coming out, was that 2016 or was that later?
They came out in early 2015, a year and a half before they brought this keyboard to all of their laptops, during which it was very clear during that year and a half that it failed a lot.
Yeah, but in 2016, they introduced the MacBook Pros with the same keyboard at the same time they filed this patent. So it shows that they had been thinking about it at some point, you know, before 2016, they had been investigating these different ways to seal up the bottom of that thing. Now, I think I brought this up when we talked about the original slimline keyboard, or maybe it was when we talked about the touch bar, but I think this is, I'll use this opportunity to once again promote the idea that I think Apple would benefit from on all of its laptops. This idea of sealing up the keycaps with a little membrane so that stuff can't get in there, just take it to the next level and make these damn things waterproof, right? If you can waterproof a phone, if you made a waterproof keyboard, which would also obviously include as a side effect the inability to get crap underneath the keys, I would imagine. I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily, but I would imagine that could be part of it. People will love you for it. How many people, Casey, spill things on their laptops? if you could, like, is it beyond us technologically speaking to make a sort of sealed keyboard that feels good? I mean, maybe these patents are just patents because Apple figured out if you do this, it makes the keyboard feel even worse. I don't know. We'll see if they ever produce something like this, but...
Well, no, I mean, we kind of know that from the smart keyboard. The iPad Pro smart keyboard has, I think, but the same butterfly switches, or at least similar feeling switches, but it has like a membrane across the whole thing. And so it is, I think, roughly water resistant at least. But it doesn't get stuff under the keys. It at least doesn't do that. So we kind of know, like, this is possible to do with just a membrane. I know that one of the Microsoft Surface notebook lines does it too, and they have issues with it, like, you know, getting dirty and looking really grimy and gross really fast. But, like, that's not to say that it has to go that way. Like, maybe different materials choices could have different results there. Like, that's not actually that bad of a thing to try. I don't know if it would feel better or worse than what we have now, but, like, the smart keyboard, like, I use the smart keyboard all the time on the iPad. I wouldn't call it great, but it's tolerable, and that's about what I can say for the notebook one as well. So it's just tolerable in slightly different ways. But you know what? The smart keyboard keys have never failed on me, not once, because stuff can't get in there. So it's, you know, not a ridiculous idea.
Do you have the problems with the smart keyboard with, like, I think it was iOS 11 or something? People are complaining the smart keyboard doesn't work reliable anymore due to, like, some change in the debouncing firmware or some crap?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's not... I haven't had... I don't know if it's related to debouncing or not. It definitely is less reliable. But that seems like an iOS software thing, like just like the way the apps behave with the keyboard attached or detached has been more buggy. Rotation has been more buggy. It's been kind of a mess. But I attribute that to iOS 11. But I don't know. Anyway, I think one challenge you might have with the idea of waterproofing a laptop is ventilation and cooling.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is obviously the MacBook is your easiest one, right? Because the reason I bring up this whole idea of waterproofing now is that Apple has slowly been sealing up its laptops, not for the purpose of waterproofing, but just for the purpose of Apple being Apple, like getting rid of moving parts and seams and making them unibody, and then the battery's not removable. And then
I think another way to look at this is decontenting.
It's a simplification. It's moving towards this platonic ideal of like this is a featureless, smooth.
They are certainly featureless.
Right. And so the MacBook, no vents, right? You still have to deal with the ports, which I think might be challenging because Apple doesn't get to define all those ports. You have to come up with the sealed but still repairably internal replaceable USB-C port or whatever. But there's not a lot of holes in a 12-inch MacBook, right? So I feel like that is a good candidate. If you can seal an iPad or an iPhone, you know, it has similar number of holes to a MacBook Adorable, the 12-inch Apple laptop. For the ones with vents and fans, I granted it's a lot harder. But even on those, if you say, look, it's not waterproof, but the top surface, the keyboard surface, if you do a spill on it, you'll be okay. Like the water will shed away and not be sucked into the vents. And the top is sealed so that it's waterproof so it can take a spill. You can't dunk the thing in water, but it's better than it was before. Where if you spill on the keyboard, you're doomed and Apple will never repair your thing again. And if this membrane keyboard... like, if they do this for crumb reasons, I say, while you're in there, see what you can do about water. Let's call it water resistance or something, you know. I just think it's kind of silly as time goes on that our phones can be dropped into a glass of water and come back out okay, but our much more expensive laptops, like a pin drop of water falls on the keyboard and filters down into the inside and starts corroding things and it's all over.
One speck of dust, $700. One speck of wet dust, $1,200.
Yeah, no, more than that. It's like total replacements. Like, sorry, it's like probably the phones. Water got in this and we don't cover water damage. I don't know if that's true of laptops, but I know the phones have those little water damage sensor thingies on them that they yell at you about if it turns out your thing has water damage.
No, it is also true of laptops.
Right.
Use desktop kids. They don't get wet. Well, I don't know. They don't get wet unless Casey's around. I bet he could find some way to get water into one of them.
Challenge accepted. I would say hold my beer, but I'm going to need it.
We are sponsored this week by Aftershocks Bone Conduction Headphones. Go to atp.aftershocks.com and use code ATP30 to get $30 off the wonderful new Trex Air, their new flagship headphones. Bone Conduction Headphones rest next to your ear, not on it, not around it, not in it. And they send small vibrations through your cheekbones that reach your inner ear. So it feels like you're wearing nothing at all, really. And especially the new Trex Air are so light. They have a full titanium wraparound band, weighs just 1.06 ounces. It's incredibly light. It's incredibly comfortable. And it feels like you're wearing nothing at all, but you hear the sound from the headphones. And you also hear the sound around you, which can be very useful for practicality and safety reasons in various conditions. And the best thing is, there's nothing in your ear. So if your ears hurt, like mine do, when you put in like regular earbuds, you won't have this problem with the Trex Air because they're not resting in your ear or they're not squishing against your ear. They're resting next to your ear with a very small contact patch. So it's also IP55 certified to repel sweat, dust, and moisture. So it's very good for bad weather or workouts or anything like that. Battery life is great on these. They have over 6 hours of battery life for continuous music and phone calls, a 20-day standby time, and they can charge fully in just 2 hours. The Trex Air also features EQ options. So if you want to boost bass or reduce vibration, you can do that. There's, of course, microphones. There's dual noise-canceling microphones to make incredibly clear phone calls with the new Trex Air. They are wonderful. If you have any problems, they have a two-year warranty. I use the Trex Air myself, and I love them. I absolutely love them. They're wonderful for hearing the world around you, which is something that most headphones really don't offer very well, if at all. With these, they're great for if you're like walking outside and you want to hear so you don't get like hit by a car or something terrible like that, or even more practical stuff, like if you're in your house and you want to hear if somebody knocks on the door or if your phone is ringing somewhere else. It's very, very useful. Check it out today, atp.aftershocks.com, and you can get $30 off the Trex Air model, which is the model I highly recommend. atp.aftershocks.com, code ATP30 for $30 off the Trex Air. Thank you so much to Aftershocks Bone Conduction Headphones for sponsoring our show. What do you guys think? I know this has been very well covered, especially on the talk show a few days ago, but what do you guys think of the rumors of a potential MacBook Air update? This to me, I think, is potentially very interesting.
Yeah, I heard that was the talk show with...
Jason
Snell was on. Yeah, Jason Snell and John Gruber were talking about that. I kind of agree with Jason about his consternation of this like somehow we can't kill this laptop. And I'm mostly coming at it from a sort of Apple should be embarrassed angle. Not so much that the MacBook Air is a bad machine, but there is one part of the machine I think is inexcusable, and that's the screen. Not because it's not in Retina, like they made all the points on the show. Some people don't care about Retina. Some people can't even see the difference. But because it has such incredibly bad viewing angles, brightness, and color reproduction. Right. It's just at this point, when it was introduced, fine. At this point, it is just a bad screen. It looks worse than basically any new PC laptop screen you could buy at any price.
Wait, hold on. Honest question. Have you seen a 12-inch MacBook screen?
Yeah, sure.
Because they, like, if you look at the 12-inch compared to the other higher-end ones, the 12-inch screen is also noticeably worse at things like viewing angle, color, everything. It's not a good screen.
But it's better than the Air.
That's true. I'll give you that. But it's not. It's still like a crap screen.
It is not. Oh, slow down. It is not a crap screen.
When you compare it to a MacBook Pro screen, of any, even the old ones.
I do that every day. I would take the MacBook Adorable one any day.
It's Retina, so it's like way better than the MacBook. But I'm just saying, for color reproduction and viewing, for a thing that Apple used to pride itself on, that they never really had crap monitors, that they always had pretty much the best monitors, and that they wouldn't let a really old monitor stay around for a long time, that they would refresh. And they have been refreshing the MacBook Air, like ripping out the, you know, changing the internals and everything like that. But leaving that screen, like it just boggles my mind, because I feel like at this point, I would never want to buy a $1,000 laptop with that screen on it. It seems inexcusable. So if they had been updating the MacBook Air to keep it limping along on life support and had also updated the screen, I would be like, well, this is not ideal. But they're, you know, they found themselves in a weird place with their product line. So let's see what they do with it. Like, I think Jason and Gruber had a good analysis of that, as they somehow, it's conceivable they somehow found themselves in a scenario where any move to replace it would result in reduced margins on one or both lines as the buyer shifted. And then Tim Cook philosophy is like, if it ain't broke, if people are still giving us money for it, don't fix it, which is a terrible from a, like, coherent product line directive. And if there is another live talk show with Apple executives on it, I really hope John asks them. I hope he doesn't ask them, because if you ask them, it seems like your laptop line has no coherent story. You can make a coherent story. Like, well, the Air is for people who like blah, 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 blah. And then you have the MacBook is for people. All you're doing is, like, listing the pros and cons of your models. But there is no coherent story to the naming, features, or pricing of the current Apple laptop line. It is a mess. And so I would state that and say, you know, like, exactly that. There's no coherent story to the naming, features, or pricing of your laptop line. Why is that? And if they want to contest that, I would push back pretty hard to say, come on, one of them's called Air, but it's not the lightest, but it's super old. It's got MagSafe on it, but the other ones don't have MagSafe. One of them's called MacBook Pro, but it's got the internals of the Air, and it's just like, your brain explodes. So I think their line is in disarray, and I think they can make, and I think the MacBook Air was a great model of laptop, but that we have the technology now to make a line of computers that spans the exact same price range that offers a better computer at the $1,000 price point than they currently offer now. And also offers a better computer at all the other ones, and, you know, depending on how you want to do it. Hey, put on MagSafe and USB-C and let people charge from both. Let's see which one people like better, right? Because then you get the advantages of Casey using his Switch charger, and the advantage of, if you trip over my card, you won't break it. And you can, maybe you can choose when you order it, whether you want the MagSafe or not, because maybe you just want to be able to use all your same charge. Anyway, or put an SD card slot in the side of it, of these computers. Or maybe have an HDMI port on one model. Like, I don't know, I'm going a little bit crazy here. But I long for the days when you could look at the line of Apple laptops and say, I see how it goes. Big, small, low price, high price. Not a lot of features, a bunch of features, and have them all look like a family. And that's not the case now. Not the case at all.
So one, I think, curiosity that I had throughout the other nice discussions about this, and again, I think listening to the talk show this week, it's a really good discussion about this from a lot of different angles. But one thought I had was, like, if they make a Retina MacBook Air, if they literally change nothing else about it except a Retina screen and maybe replacing the two Thunderbolt 2 ports, does it have one or two? Replacing its Thunderbolt 2 ports with USB-C ports. And then, of course, you know, a modern chipset of the same type that's currently in the MacBook Escape. Would anybody still buy the MacBook Escape?
No, like that's the problem we've talked about. If you improve the MacBook Air, why would anyone buy a MacBook? Or a MacBook. Why would anyone? No, sorry, a MacBook Pro, rather, not a MacBook.
The MacBook Escape, the 13-inch MacBook without Touch Bar, is by many measures a MacBook Air. It has the MacBook Air class processors, the MacBook Air class chipset, and everything else. It's the same approximate size and weight. It's a little bit, you know, it's slightly different, but roughly the same size and weight as the 13-inch MacBook Air. But if you put a Retina screen in the old ancient MacBook Air body that was designed in 2010, I bet it would sell better than the 13-inch MacBook Escape.
It would be a better laptop. It has an SD card slot. It has MagSafe, the option for MagSafe. It has legacy USB ports, which Apple acknowledges is a thing that some people want. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put them on the iMac Pro, right?
Yeah.
If you showed a regular person which one of these laptops do you think is better and which one do you want and didn't tell them about the price and they weren't sensitive to styling cues that clearly indicate that the MacBook Air is super old, right? They would say, well, that one's got more stuff. It's got more features. It's got more things. And this magnet power cable is really smart, right? Why would you ever pick the other one? If we tell you, guess what? That one's $300 more. You'd be like, well, who would pay $300 more to have no ports on the side for a computer that is basically the same size and weight? And it perceptibly seems thicker because it doesn't taper, right? Like the MacBook Air is thicker on one end but thinner on the other, but it seems smaller because it gets skinny just for that perception type thing. Like that's the and it's fine if they do that. Like if they want to remake their line in that way, you'd have to sort this type of thing out. But instead, they leave it in the current scenario where the old one is clearly old and has serious downsides versus the regular one in terms of that terrible screen they have on it, right? The new one is expensive for no perceptible reason, and you trade off a bunch of stuff, and then it gets even more super expensive, and you still don't get your ports back, and you still have no MagSafe, and the keyboard is weird and breaks all the time. So they need to do something. I really want them to just clean house on the laptop line and say, all new line, one nice family, unified in appearance features, and has a coherent ramp from expensive to inexpensive. And by the way, at all price points and at all sizes, every one of them is better in some way, whether it has more features or better reliability or, you know, faster or whatever.
Yeah, I suspect we're going to see some kind of major movement in the laptop line this year. I really hope we do. The current line has so many of these like weird issues, not to mention, you know, some of the problems it has, but like just like these like weird things about like that make it, you know, more or less compelling or seemingly weirdly priced in certain ways or really segmented in other ways. Like it needs help. And I have a feeling Apple knew that 2 years ago, like shortly after it launched. And I have a feeling they've worked to fix it. And so the only question is how they're fixing it. And I don't expect this to be, you know, giving me all my hopes and dreams or anything, but I do expect change and hopefully improvement. And so we'll see what that means.
Speaking of hopes and dreams, this is a tough question in the style of these recent ones that listeners have been sending us. For the high-end laptops, which is where we're all shopping, well, you two are shopping because I don't buy laptops.
I'm getting towards that point.
Yeah. If you had to pick one port to add to the current crop of MacBook Pro ports, let's just pick the 15-inch MacBook Pro because that does the most. You can only pick one. For your own personal purposes, not for like what would make a better laptop for Apple to sell, what would you pick?
On a 15-inch, no question, an SD card reader.
Casey?
I'm torn between ancient USB and SD card reader. I would HDMI would also be convenient.
Pick one.
I know. I'm thinking.
See, and like to me, like if it's not the 15-inch, like if you ask me what port I would add to the MacBook Escape, it would be a third of anything, like a third USB-C port, just one more of anything, because that's what it most desperately needs, like the 12-inch too,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, the same thing. I would kill for a second USB-C port in my...
That's why I picked the 15, just to see, like, you know, that you feel like there's enough USB-Cs on the 15, but you can add one more thing, you know, what would it be?
I am very torn between SD, between old USB, and between HDMI, but I think if I had to pick... I would probably come down on SD card reader because I don't find a need for plugging in via HDMI that often, and I have a dongle for it. I don't have a need for plugging in legacy USB stuff that often, and I have a dongle for it. But I do have an SD card reader that I like quite a lot, but it would be more convenient to just be able to slot that thing right in the computer.
Yeah, like to me, it's like you can solve a lot of the annoyances of the new laptop ports are solved by just having a lot of them. Like, you know, like when you have four of them, well, technically, really, you have three of them because one of them has a power plug in it. But, you know, when you have three useful ones. Well,
unless
ones.
You have pass-through. Like, you're I hear your point, 100%.
Yeah, but then you're in Dongletown, and it, like, okay,
well,
so
you're
anyway.
Going to be in Dongletown regardless.
Yeah, I know, well, that's part of the problem.
We're all landowners in Dongletown, my friend.
Yeah, like, but I feel like, you know, like the other ports, you know, you can fix a lot of the inconvenience of USB-C only laptops with getting new cables for old devices. Like you can go on, you know, Monoprice or Amazon or whatever and get inexpensive cables that have USB-C on one end and whatever your peripheral needs on the other end. And you can just replace all your cables and you know, there's some issues with hubs and multiplying those that I've talked about before, which is still annoying. But I feel like you can reduce a lot of the annoyance with just like new cables. But if you need SD cards as part of your workflow, there's no way to reduce that annoyance. You're always going to have like an SD card hanging out of the side of it through a cable or something. Like that sucks. And when it's built in, it sucks less. So like other problems can be solved with either time or cabling choices or peripheral choices, but not having an SD card reader, if you use SD cards, is always a pain.
So the reason I asked this question is because I've been thinking about it a lot lately, and I can tell you if you surveyed all the people at my office at work, they would all say HDMI. Because every time, increasingly, when we land in a conference room and someone needs to project, never mind the fact that they should really, with the number of Macs that are in this office, they should really have Apple TVs connected to every single thing so we could AirPlay to them, because it would solve this problem in a much nicer way. Steve Jobs would approve. You don't need an HDMI port. You just need to be able to AirPlay to everything. I agree, Steve, but you can't fight the IT department. Anyway, they would all say HDMI because it's so frustrating. We all sit down there and it's like we look around for the one person with the 2015 laptop who can actually plug in because everyone forgot their dongle.
Wow. Right?
And it used to be there was just one person with the new laptop and we would laugh at them. And now there's like one person left with the old laptop. And once the old laptop disappears, there's going to be a bunch of people sitting around unable to project. I don't understand why they don't put the adapters for this. But anyway, that's what people at work would say, but that's not what I would say, because in my regular life, if I was buying a laptop for myself, I don't need to connect to HDMI. So I would never pick HDMI, but work totally would. I would have said in the past SD, right? Because I do have cameras that have SD cards. When I go on vacation, I like to offload pictures from my camera to my thing without a dongle. It's convenient. Build it in. It's small. It's skinny. It'll fit fine. But the more I've been thinking about it, the more I've been getting attached to the idea of taking a 15-inch MacBook Pro and adding MagSafe. And still having the ability to charge by any of the USB-C things, like not removing that ability, but adding MagSafe as an addition, because I feel like you get the twofer. You get MagSafe, which is better to trip over and stuff. You get, as I think it was it Jason Snell or maybe it was Gruber saying, you get the indicator light, which I think is a useful feature when you have your closed laptop and you plug it in to make sure you see the little light that shows amber or green to show whether it's fully charged or is charging, right?
Yeah. It's a great feature. It's not like, and Apple had that, like, what, 15 years ago? Like, it's not a new thing in laptop design.
Right. And you also get one of your ports back. Now you really do have four ports instead of three. If you want the convenience of, I just have USB-C charger with me on vacation, and it can charge everything, you've got it. But also, you could have the MagSafe. And then the only question is, what do you ship in the box? Do you ship MagSafe? Do you ship USB? Or do you ship both? And probably Apple would make you pick or something. And I know it would be backsliding. And I know MagSafe had problems too. And that's why I feel like, ship them both. Let people decide what they want to use. Hell, Apple can collect stats about what they use and anonymously send them back with its differential privacy for how often laptops are charging via MagSafe versus how often they're charging via USB-C. I probably would get more benefit out of SD, but I'm finding the twofer of getting a port back and having the option of MagSafe irresistible. And so now I'm envisioning, before I was envisioning Apple revising its laptops by adding an SD card slot, and now I'm envisioning them adding back MagSafe, which I think is astronomically less likely than adding an SD card slot, because it just, it would be like egg on face of like, oh, remember MagSafe? We're bringing it back. That would be a tough sell. Whereas SD, God, there's so much room alongside those, the edges of those 15-inch laptops, right? It's just a giant expanse with these two little tiny USB-C holes. An SD card slot, even Johnny Ive can tolerate the aesthetic marring of a very skinny, discrete SD card slot in there. Hell, it looks fine on Marco's 2015 MacBook Pro. I think it would be fine on a 2018 model.
One thing also that they could do that I think it probably goes against their sensibilities, but I think it probably shouldn't, because I think it's one of the biggest engineering flops of the new lineup, is that the number of USB, like, to me, like, one of the biggest problems with these, as I've said numerous times, is just there aren't enough ports. Like, if you're going to sell us on an all USB-C world, okay, we can adapt to that over time with dongles and stuff and new cables and everything. There still aren't enough ports, especially with one of them being lost to power. As you said, like, you basically lose one during most practical usage for most people most of the time. So you know, like the MacBook Escape basically has one port. Casey's MacBook One has no ports,
pretty much.
right. And so, like, and the, you know, the, and the 15 inch has three. And if you look at, and you know, the 13 Pro also. And if you look at, like, you know, what the previous ones had, like, you could connect more than that amount of things to them without adapters. And I feel like one of the, if you look at the engineering behind this, one of the challenges, for example, one of the reasons why the MacBook Escape only has two ports is because of limitations of how many Thunderbolt channels you can deliver, because Apple decided to make all of these USB-C ports also Thunderbolt 3 ports, except for the one in Casey's MacBook One. And that's a choice that they made. They didn't have to. It is possible to have a USB-C port that does not support Thunderbolt 3, like the one in Casey's MacBook One. And so Apple, no, trust me, this is in many ways a good thing. You just need more of them. And so, like, I feel like, you know, one of the biggest ways to solve the annoyance of these laptops is to just, if you're going to insist on USB-C, okay, but we need more of them. Two total, including your power hole, is not enough. If you can't make them on certain models, if you can't make them full-blown Thunderbolt 3 ports, which you already can't, they're already not Thunderbolt 3 in the MacBook One, and the ones on the right side of the 13-inch MacBook Pro are half bandwidth or whatever it is. So, like, there's already exceptions. The cable that comes with it that charges from the brick to the computer is a USB-C cable that is not a Thunderbolt cable. In fact, it's a USB 2.0 USB-C cable, which shouldn't even exist, but they do, and that's what it is. You know, there's already all these exceptions to what the ports can and can't do. In addition, Thunderbolt usage in practice is pretty low, and it is not the common case. What most people are plugging into these things, it needs either just power or power and USB. It's, you know, most of the peripherals being plugged into these ports do not need Thunderbolt 3. And so by Apple taking these ports on most of these laptops except for Casey's and saying, we can only have as many as the Thunderbolt controllers allow us to with this chipset or whatever, that's very limiting to the number of ports you can have. If they had like, you know, two to four of them that could do Thunderbolt 3 and two more that couldn't, maybe on the other side or whatever, that, you know, that's not ideal, but I think that's better than not having enough ports to do basic things that you need. So I know it would be more complicated. I know they wouldn't be able to put the little Thunderbolt lightning bolt symbol next to all of them, but I think that is the best compromise that we have. If we're going to do an all USB-C world, we need more of these ports. And it is a waste to suggest that they all need to have Thunderbolt 3. I mean, look, one of them, most of the time, is used for power and nothing else, no data at all. You're wasting Thunderbolt 3 bandwidth on a port that transfers nothing except power. So, like, obviously, like, you know, there's a major engineering inefficiency in tying Thunderbolt 3 to USB-C for all these laptops. If you can separate them, you could give us way more ports. Well, not way more, but you can give us, like, two more ports at least on most of these without having any bandwidth challenges.
You could give way more. Like, they have USB inside these cases. You could give six USB-C ports along with four Thunderbolt ports. Like, I feel like they have the controller capacity or space inside the case to put a controller that can support that. Like, USB connections are cheap in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes, I think, more complicated, like, with, like, the wiring and stuff, if the other ones could also do some of the other alternate modes, like, if they can take power input or if they can do certain video output types. But because I know Thunderbolt's required for some of the alternate modes, but not all of them, or it is one of the alternate modes. I don't know, something like that. But, like, tying this to Thunderbolt 3 made these ports very limited in number and probably fairly expensive to implement. But that was an unforced error. They didn't need to do that. I understand why they did, but I think that was the wrong move, and I hope they fix it.
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, you just said unforced error, and to my ears, it was the correct usage of the term, and I'm really uncomfortable with my reality right now.
Wait, so is that a sports term? Because I learned it from John.
It is a sports term.
Okay, to me, it's a Syracuse term.
Wow. Well, that now my reality is back to being reality, so I appreciate that. Let's go on a adventure together, a little mental exercise together. It is 2016 or whatever year it was that the USB-C MacBook Pros came out. Doesn't matter when it was, but whenever they debuted, it's that year, that moment. And within a few weeks of each other, the new MacBook Pros come out. Let's pick on the 15 specifically. There's a new MacBook Pro. It's 15 inches. It has four USB-C and Thunderbolt ports. Simultaneously, Lenovo or Dell or somebody else comes out with effectively the same thing as they are off to do. And it has the same four physical USB-C ports, but only two of them are Thunderbolt. Do you know what the three of us would be doing at that moment? We would be saying, oh, haha, these idiot PC vendors. Now that you have to worry about whether or not you're plugging into the right port, what a ridiculous mess that is.
We didn't say that on the MacBook, where, as Marco just pointed out, it's a situation now where you have to know one side is special than the other. That's been a thing on Apple laptops for a long time, that certain ports on one side are better than the ports on the other side. That's been true for many laptops in Apple's history. And yeah, it's always kind of annoying, but we understand why it is the way it is, and we accept it. I don't think it's a source of ridicule.
All right. I just feel like all I can imagine is all of us going, haha, those idiot PC people.
We have talked about that as an inherent problem with using the same connector for all these things. I still think that the advantages of using the same connector for all of them outweigh the disadvantages. But, you know, as Marco just said, your laptop has a port, has a hole that's exactly the same shape as the ones in Marco's, and yet it is not capable of the things that Marco's old ones were capable of, right? It's both the same cables fit into both of them, but if you plug in a thing that expects Thunderbolt into yours, it won't work. And there's no indication for that, physically speaking. I don't even know if there's a little lightning bolt thingy next to them anymore.
No.
So, I mean, that's just the nature.
Well, it wouldn't be next to yours.
Yeah. At point, yeah, maybe you shouldn't ask me after all. Yeah.
So, I think the implicit assumption, I'm also thinking of my own feelings about underlying this discussion, is that I'm still hoping, that when Apple does, you know, make a big revision to their laptop line, that one or more of the new laptops they introduce will have more ports than the thing that it's replacing. And that's why I keep getting to, like, what do you think they'll add or whatever. If I'm wrong about that, and if they introduce a whole new laptop line that's like the next generation after, like, this current crop of 2016, 2017, like, they've had time to process the feedback from the market and, you know, so on and so forth, and none of them have any more ports, I will be extremely disappointed. Like, I realize to myself that I've just been assuming. I basically, since the Apple roundtable about the Mac, when they talked about the Mac Pro, from that point on, I read into what they said with my hopes and dreams of saying, yeah, I know you're talking about the Mac Pro and the iMac Pro. Like, I know that's what this is really about, and about rededication to the Mac. But the few sentences they said about the laptops, I latched on to really hard and said, that means eventually, you know, after, you know, 2-year cycle, whatever, takes a long time, like, not immediately, but eventually, when they do the next big laptop revision, one or more of them will have more ports. And I don't know what I'm going to do if that turns out not to be the case. Like, my faith in, I'm already a laptop hater, I guess, but my faith in Apple's laptops will be fundamentally shaken, because so far it's still just like they made a wrong turn and things were already in the pipeline and they couldn't really do much about the revision for 2017, all they did was add the rubber gaskets and stuff. And it's like, hopefully they know what's wrong. Next time they do the big revision, that'll be the time to make more different fundamental decisions. But if the next ones come along and they're exactly the same set of just USB-C only, MacBook One is still the MacBook One, the other ones still just have two ports, and, you know, and there's no changes and no MagSafe and no SD card, no HDMI, no, like, nobody gets anything, not even an additional USB-C port, nothing. I'm going to be super disappointed. I'll probably console myself by hugging my new Mac Pro, but but I don't know about you. Have you internalized that as a thing you expect, and so now you're set up to be disappointed by not being there, or are you still, like, pessimistic and you'll be pleasantly surprised if they do anything?
That I will be stunned if there's any sort of, not really mea culpa, but, like, if they add any sort of ports to any of these laptops, I will be flabbergasted. I'm not saying it's unreasonable, but I do think it is a, what did you say, like, egg on the face sort of admission that, oh, maybe we didn't get this exactly right.
If they add a USB-C or a Thunderbolt 3, I feel like it's not an admission of anything. It's just they added a more port. Even that will be something. It'll say, look, we realize USB-C is great, but when you only get two of them, one's taken with power, it really limits things. So now you got one more, so you got three.
Yeah, I mean, and let's be realistic here. Also, like, if you look at the side of one of these things, and if you look at, like, the height of ports, I think it's very unlikely that we will see the return of USB-A or even MagSafe, because I don't think they fit. I think they're too tall. I don't think they could reasonably fit those.
Oh, it would have to be a new MagSafe. Yeah, it would have to be MagSafe 3.
Yeah, right. Because I can't see them doing that. And I'm honestly, I'm totally okay with USB-C charging. I wish the charger was nicer. I wish it had things like the charging light and some kind of version of MagSafe would be nice. But other than that, I actually like USB-C charging because you can get third-party chargers that have, like, you know, like the wonderful Anker one that has the built-in USB charging also. Like, it makes the charging situation much more flexible, and then you can travel a little bit lighter and stuff like that. So I like that. But if you look at what can actually fit in this new super thin case design, not a lot can. USB-C, you know, you could fit more of them. And maybe, you know what, Apple? Maybe you could put them a little further apart because they're really close to each other and it makes it a little bit annoying to use. also, the headphone jack should move back to the left side where it belongs because there's a reason why headphones were always on the left side of laptops before. It's because when you have a headphone cable that only has a wire on one side, historically, that has been conventionally on the left ear cup. So your headphone cable goes down the left ear cup, down your left arm, into the left side port of the laptop. When it's on the right side, you have to cross your headphone cable over your laptop, which sucks. So that's wrong. Anyway.
You can wrap it around the back. Oh, by the way, speaking of ports on different sides, that's another thing I appreciate about USB power, that you can connect the power to either side. So depending on like where you are on the couch or wherever, if you're in some weird place, that you can do it. Like, that's why I think they should always keep that. And I really don't ever expect them to make MagSafe 3, but I've been musing on it lately.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think if we look at like what kind of ports we might realistically actually get, I wouldn't expect USB-A. I wouldn't expect MagSafe. SD cards are actually plausible. That, I think, could fit. If I'm not sure if they want to, but again, I think that would go a long way towards addressing a lot of people's complaints. HDMI almost certainly won't fit. They could do mini HDMI, but they won't. You know, they're going to rely on Thunderbolt and USB-C for that. But ultimately, I think the most realistic option is to either get no port changes at all, which, like John, I would be very disappointed by, or to get more USB-C ports, which I would be very happy with. So we'll see.
Yeah, more USB-C ports is the most likely. I'm still rooting for SD. I think back when we talked about this originally, I said just add an SD card and it'll be fine. But the more I think about the port being taken up by power and experiencing myself, the more I think more USB-C would be a good idea. And by the way, for a MagSafe 3 design, again, not that they're doing this, but if you give up on the notion that the magnet is on the side of the computer, you can do lots of interesting things. Imagine if MagSafe looked like a little shovel and it was large surface area magnet on the sort of on the bottom, like in an L shape. Like it clipped onto the corner and tucked underneath the little curve. Like there are things you could do to add much more magnet surface area while keeping it very thin. Like we don't have to think inside the box defined by MagSafe as it previously existed. Magnetically detachable charging cables for trip proofness is, I still think, a good idea and an idea that could manifest in a way that will work with the thinnest possible laptops still.
So in the chat room, Espressly asked an interesting question. They said, would you prefer a second USB-C on the Adorable or a headphone jack? And I presume the genesis of this is that on the opposite side of the laptop, on the right-hand side, and Marco, you're right to say that that is bananas, but on the right-hand side of the laptop of the Adorable, there is a headphone jack. And I would absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, trade in that headphone jack for another USB-C port without question.
Because you've got AirPods, and that's right. Why.
Yeah, I mean, and all sorts of other Bluetooth headphones. And yeah, there are occasions that I have plugged in headphones to this laptop, but they are extremely rare. And I would get much more, maybe not daily, but much more frequent use out of a second USB-C port than I would the headphone jack that's there today.
There's no reason to make that trade, though. We already did 20 shows about complaining about it. There's no room for another USB-C port. There is. There's room for another USB-C port and the headphone. It will be fine.
We are sponsored this week by Jamf Now. Create your free account today at jamf.com/ATP to start securing your business today. Jamf Now lets you help set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices on demand. It's pretty easy to keep track of, say, your own devices, your own Mac, your own iPad, or your own iPhone. But what about the other Apple devices in your organization? As a business grows, it gets harder to manage everybody's iPads, iPhones, and Macs. And this is especially true if employees are in different locations. With Jamf Now, that's J-A-M-F Now, you can check real-time inventory, you can configure Wi-Fi and email settings, deploy applications, protect your sensitive company data, and even lock or wipe a device from anywhere. Jamf Now helps you manage and protect your devices so you can focus on your business instead, and you don't need any IT experience or expertise to be able to use Jamf Now. It's super easy to use. Start securing your business today by setting up your first three devices for free, and you can add more for just $2 a month per device. Create your free account today and see for yourself. It's pretty great at jamf.com/ATP. That's JAMF.com/ATP. Secure your business today with Jamf Now. Thank you so much to Jamf Now for sponsoring our show.
WWDC is announced. It is in San Jose again. It is the 4th through the 8th of June, which is phenomenally great because that's what the three of us guessed it would be. And that's what we booked hotel tickets for a long time ago. So that's great news. It is going to be apparently about Marzipan or whatever it's being called today, if you believe what people are looking at on the invitation, which I think is a exercise in futility because the invitation never means anything. But also of interest on that Monday, which is the 4th, all three of your hosts will be there to do another episode in addition of ATP Live, which is part of a, what are they calling it? Like a podcast fair or something like that?
Festival.
Festival. That's what I was looking for. Thank you.
Which means two live podcasts at AltConf.
Whee! So yeah, so we're going to be doing a kind of a joint thing between us, AltConf, like Marco said, and Relay. They're going to be doing an episode of Connected in addition to some other things that I genuinely don't know what's happening, but I know enough to know that it's going to be an extravaganza. So if you are interested in coming to see ATP Live in San Jose on Monday, June 4th, you can get tickets at AltConf's website, and we will put a link in the show notes. They are $5 a piece if they are still available. I honestly haven't even looked. That money goes to AltConf, which is good because AltConf is free. So we don't see any of that money, but I don't think that's a bad thing at all. And additionally, you can get tickets to the Relay thing as well or to AltConf. And it's worth noting that even if WWDC, if the lottery doesn't work out well for you, in addition to AltConf, there's also Layers that will be going on the same time, run by friend of the show, Jesse Char, and a couple of other lovely women. Actually, I think it's just Elaine and she. But anyway, they are awesome. They are super, super awesome. And the conference is super, super awesome. And the snacks at the conference are super, super awesome. So no matter how you slice it, Layers is great. AltConf is great. WWDC is great. Plenty of options if you can find yourself in San Jose that week. Is that it? Wow, that was fast.
You covered it pretty well.
Go team.
Summarized in chief.
Yeah, chief summarizer in chief. Chief actually doing my job for once.
We can talk about the WWC graphics, which you alluded to earlier. I think some of the commentary about this, or commentary, tweets, whatever, about this have kind of combined two things that are not really related. One is the artwork Apple puts on the email invitations to select press when they are going to have an event. Come hear us talk about whatever we, you know, like the iPhone announcement event or, you know, Mac update, press events, right? And traditionally they make a little graphic and usually sometimes a little phrase underneath it, right? And then there is what we're actually talking about here, which is every year when they do WWDC, there's some kind of graphical motif or theme. It's used like in the banners that hang in the exhibition halls and the rooms where they have things. It's used in all the websites and the materials and the emails. And it started off pretty generic many, many years ago, but it has evolved so that now each WWC has kind of like a branding theme or flavor. So for the press invitations, sometimes those have been intentionally pointing to something they're going to say. Like the one with the little rotating apple with the like back to the Mac thing behind it, where they were going to talk more about the Mac. And guess what? They talked more about the Mac. Some of them are only explicable in hindsight, where you can tell some of the graphic treatments on the invitation were the same ones they would use when they announced a particular product, whether it's the iPhone or whatever. But sometimes it's just a fun graphical theme that has to do with, hey, we have an app store and you make apps for it, and apps are these little rounded rectangle things. So we use lots of rounded rectangles in our stuff. But I would say that there is a fairly solid track record of some of the time the press invitations do, in fact, intentionally indicate something that they're going to talk about in a vague way. WWDC art, on the other hand, has a much worse track record of communicating anything about what's going to be presented other than the fact that it's a developer conference where they tell you about developing for Apple platforms. As far as I can recall, there has never been a WWDC website that hinted strongly at the specific nature of a specific thing they're going to announce. Probably mostly because at the time this artwork is commissioned, they're not even entirely sure what's going to be presented at WWDC, and things, you know, are going into and out of the keynote and into and out of the sessions for a long time. So I feel like this, trying to read the tea leaves in this artwork is probably about as useful as trying to read the tea leaves in last year's artwork, which was all those top views of people.
Oh yeah, the little people. Right?
Which was like, it's a particular artist who does that style of stuff. And it was that aesthetic theme was all over WWDC last year, but it had nothing to do with anything that was presented. It was just a cool, fun marketing style that talked about, you know, people, developers are people, and they're doing developy things, and it's fun and interesting or whatever, right? This one looks super cool, and it's got these cool 3D representations of, like, you know, UI elements from iOS and the Mac. It's because, and it's got curly braces and other weird shapes. It communicates, like, hey, these are things you use when you're developing for our platforms, and this is a conference about developing for our platforms. It's really hard to read anything into it, but people are so, they so want to see something in it. They're saying, see how these are all 3D? It's showing that they're moving away from flat design because nothing is flat in this. Get it, man? And like, it's really reaching. And I have to admit, when I saw this, my thought was nostalgia, because one of the elements in this very cool looking, like there's an animation that goes along with a very cool looking 3D rendered thing showing a bunch of controls. One of the elements in the lower left corner are three translucent spheres with symbols in them, an X, a minus, and then two little arrowy things like a box with a slash through it. And I tweeted about it with a one word tweet that said memories dot dot dot. A lot of people didn't know. they responded and thought I was referring to things in like iOS 10 or something, or you know, or pre iOS 7 or whatever. What I was actually referring to was the window control widgets, what we used to call the stoplight widgets. Red for window closed, yellow for minimizing, green for what used to be zoom and is now full screen or whatever the hell it does now. They used to be rendered as if they were glossy spheres, and when you brought your mouse near them or hovered over one of them, you'd see these symbols appear in the spheres. And they were glossy spheres just like these spheres. Oh, this is just viewing them from a different angle. Later in the life of the Mac operating system, they became flatter, and eventually they just became like what they are now, which is like, you know, flat colors of red, yellow, and green. They don't even look like they're spheres at all, right? Even though they still have the symbols in them. But floating in this thing are not the flat window widgets of today's High Sierra. Floating in this thing are the window widgets of, you know, Cheetah, Puma, and Panther. macOS 10, I forgot, I missed Jaguar, sorry. macOS 10.01, 2, and 3, I think, is how long these things lasted before they start getting really flat. And that, I thought, was a nice nostalgic nod, or an indication that the Mac is considered legacy. But you know, it's a nice nod towards the past, because most of the other controls that you see here are clearly elements from iOS or elements from applications that are popularized by iOS, like the little dot, dot, dot when someone's typing in Messages, right? I think it's the same graphic they use in Messages on the Mac, but I associate it with iOS just because that's where, you know, text messaging first came to the Apple platforms. So my take is that you should not read into these type of graphics. I think this is an awesome graphic. I love the aesthetic theme, and I'm just enjoying it as cool branding for WWDC.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. So we will all be there, and I'm excited for it. It's one of my favorite times of year, and it's really, really fun. I don't really care at all about texture, so I don't know which one of you added this to the show notes, but do you want to take it away?
Apparently, magazines are a really hot business right now. It's really a growth industry Apple's getting into here.
Yeah, you really messed that one up, Marco.
So we should explain what this thing is. I hadn't heard of it before today. Surprise. because it's really popular. But anyway, Apple, as an Apple press release and or PR person would say, Apple acquires small companies all the time. You know, and it actually is really a high number. Every time they say, like, did you know that last year Apple acquired 35 companies or some huge number? Like, really? They, you know, it's mostly small. Like, Apple doesn't want to buy them when they're a $10 bazillion company. They want to get them before that. Sometimes they buy companies just for the people, sometimes for the technologies or patents. Rarely do they buy them for complete working businesses, but that does happen too. Like Beats, they bought Beats and then continue to sell Beats headphones as Beats headphones, right? I think that's maybe the one of the most recent full-fledged businesses they purchased. So Texture seems like one of the small ones. It's not clear to me whether they bought it for the business or the people or the tech or anything like that. But it, what it is described as is Netflix for magazines, where you pay a flat fee and get access to a bunch of magazines in the same way you pay a flat fee every month for Netflix and you get access to a bunch of movies. Why does Apple need to buy this? I'm not sure why they might want to buy it, but Apple has in the past shown that they're interested in being some kind of a platform aid to periodicals. We all remember Newsstand, Marco, I'm sure most fondly. And that was an attempt to do something like this. Newsstand did not work out so well. Newsstand is now gone, but it signals Apple's interest in this. Texture strikes me as, all right, the approach with Newsstand of making this weird app slash folder where a bunch of things go and putting weird limitations on them and giving them, you know, recurring structures, like the whole Newsstand thing didn't work out. Having individual applications for individual things, but having them be Newsstand savvy, that model didn't work for us. Let's try this model. And this model seems a little bit more like Apple News, where Apple itself could potentially make an application. And within that application, you see a bunch of magazines, just like within Apple News, you see a bunch of news. And other content, you know, content providers can participate in Apple News, not by launching their own application that is Apple News powered, but rather by getting their news into the one and only Apple News application. Texture is an established business that works in a certain way, so I'm not sure if Apple's going to rebrand it or just put it out the way it is or just scrap Texture entirely and take those people and tell them to make Newsstand version 2. This time it'll be better. but as Marco or maybe Casey pointed out, it's great that they're kind of into that, but I'm not sure magazines on computers or otherwise are really where it's at in terms of a growth industry. But I would give Apple full credit for recognizing the Newsstand didn't work out, sunsetting it in a fairly graceful way. As I think Marco said, the best time to cancel something is when no one notices that you cancel it, and many people don't realize Newsstand is gone now. Because if you never really news it, you're like, oh, is Newsstand gone? Or if you remember what Newsstand was, yeah, it's gone. And no one really kicked up a fuss about it. So that was good. And I think it's worth taking another run at. I know I read magazines, and I do have individual app. You know, I have like the Edge magazine application. Like, I read magazines on my iPads. I'm not totally offended by that idea. I read ebooks on my iPad too. And so if Apple wants to make a really nice service application thingy for reading magazines, sure, give it a shot. Why shouldn't they be allowed to give that a try?
Yeah, no argument here. But just, this was not on my radar before, and as soon as we cease talking about it, it will not be on my radar again.
Do either one of you read magazines at all on any iOS device?
No.
I don't read magazines at all on anything ever.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I still read Car and Driver on paper, and I read Edge on paper and also in iOS, because I think their iOS app, I mean, it's not great, but it's not the bad old days of like the original Zinio. For all I know, this is the new Zinio behind the scenes. I have no idea what the technology powers it is, but it's not just a bunch of PDFs they throw onto your screen. Although with today's Retina, they could probably do that and it would probably be okay, especially on a 12.9 inch, because it's practically magazine size, and with the Retina screen, it would look great. I'm mostly doing it for Edge and Car and Driver because I like the content, but the presentation on iOS isn't bad. And it's nice not to have to carry around, if you're going on vacation and you want to read through your last three issues of Edge magazine, to have them all on your iPad rather than three paper things. Yeah, it's convenient. So I will probably download this and try it and see how good the app is and if there are any magazines that I care about in there. I doubt I'll subscribe to it, though.
Cool.
I have nothing to say about this at all.
I know. I don't care. And maybe I should care, but I just don't
Apple
care.
Buys leading manufacturer of fax machines.
Fax machines. Yeah. I mean, so here's the thing with magazines. Like, we're making fun of them because magazines is the old world or whatever. But websites, most websites are not that different from magazines. And once you have a magazine that publishes through an application, it's like, is this just like a closed version of the web and a closed version of a web browser? Maybe. But, websites and magazines still seem slightly different. Like, magazines have websites, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just nostalgic for the old days of magazines. And there's lots of legacy businesses that are tied to the magazine format that I'm glad to see allowed to live another decade or two through an effort like this.
All right. So time for Ask ATP. Matt Wallen writes, my Mac Pro does not have a Wi-Fi card. Wait, this is a Mac Pro question. I don't care. Bill Balinor writes, I'm just kidding. My Mac Pro does not have a Wi-Fi card. My wife and son both have accounts on the Mac Pro, and I was thinking of using Migration Assistant, copy stuff from the old machine to the new. Can I connect them via Ethernet for this purpose? Does or will it matter that the new machine will be running on High Sierra and the old machine is El Capitan? I've looked for specific documentation on this online and haven't found a satisfyingly definitive answer. Now, I don't think I have ever used Migration Assistant ever. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying that I'm doing things the right way. It's just I like to kind of start fresh each time. I know that this is also a little bit different because you're talking about other people and they may not want to start fresh, even though you do. But I don't really have any good answers with regard to Migration Assistant. Have you guys used that? I thought both of you had.
I definitely have. I'm a big proponent of Migration Assistant. I think there are a couple parts to this question. Starting at the very end, I've looked for specific documentation, haven't found anything. I almost guarantee that there is satisfying definitive documentation related to this on Apple's website. But yes, sometimes it can be hard to find. The beginning of the question, going back to the beginning, I can connect via all these different things. I don't have Wi-Fi. Does it matter? I can tell you that you do not want to use Migration Assistant over Wi-Fi if you can at all help it. So the fact that your Mac Pro doesn't have a Wi-Fi card, don't worry about it. I would never recommend doing it. It was worse when Wi-Fi was slower. It's better that now that Wi-Fi is faster, but I have not had good luck with using Migration Assistant over Wi-Fi. The good news is that most reasonably modern Macs can do Migration Assistant through almost any of their ports. Like, I don't know if they can do it over the headphone jack yet, but, you know, who knows?
Like the old iPod Shuffle syncing over the headphone jack?
Yeah. I used to do it through FireWire. You can do it through Ethernet. You can do it through Thunderbolt. You can do all, there's all sorts of ways that Migration Assistant will work. The bad news is figuring out how to get it to work, especially with the more obscure ports, can be tricky. So what I would recommend is going back to Apple's website and digging through the stuff and finding the documentation for your specific computer, and it will usually tell you, and by the way, from your computer, you can only migrate to this set of computers through these interfaces. Like there is like sort of a matrix of what connections can I use and how new is the computer. And you can unfortunately find yourself in a situation where you're trying to migrate from like a really old computer to a really new one when there's no great way to do it, except for maybe Ethernet, but then you need an Ethernet adapter or whatever. But I have never, as someone who keeps computers for a long time, I've never kept one long enough that I was unable to run Migration Assistant. So I would suggest using the fastest connection you can. Ethernet is probably sufficient, and it's probably the sort of the baseline, so try to do that if you possibly can. Find the docs for it and just give it a try. I think you will be mostly pleased with the results. I always have been. I find like that Migration Assistant really does migrate my stuff. And yes, it does take a long time, but the amount of time it takes when I do the math works out to be roughly amount of data it has to transfer, you know, divided by the transfer rate or whatever.
I have had almost similar luck as that. The only differences I would suggest are when you connect the old Mac via target disk mode, it tends to be a significantly faster. Migration Assistant has a pretty big problem that I think it's had basically forever, in that it is terrible at estimating how much time you have left. And it will frequently get into a state where it appears as though it's making no progress at all. And it could stay there for hours or even days. And that's very frustrating. It's very hard to tell often what it's doing, whether it is still going to go, how long it's still going to go for.
That's why I said do the math. Like, if you know you have a 1 terabyte hard drive that's mostly full and you know your connection is 1 gigabit, like, do the division, figure out how long you think it's going to take, and use that as your outside, you know, like to get an idea of how long you think it's going to take. If it takes 10 times that thing, something has probably gone wrong. But don't believe the progress bar because it doesn't know.
Well, anyway, I have had significantly better luck with doing it via target disk mode on the sending machine rather than like having both machines run the Migration Assistant app. This would probably also, if there's any problems with the old one being El Capitan, target disk mode would probably avoid those problems a little bit more likely or more easily than you know, running the Migration Assistant app on both sides. But also, yeah, it's just I've found the disk method to be way faster and way more reliable, and I have never had it reach one of those states where it seems like it's going to just take forever. Whereas over Wi-Fi and even gigabit Ethernet, I've had that happen. So by doing target disk mode, you have most of the options that John suggested. On the old Mac Pro, the Mac Pros that had Wi-Fi are optional, would be 2006 to 2008. I believe it was standard after that, so it's pretty old. It will definitely predate all Thunderbolt, because Thunderbolt came after the Mac Pro. So your best port is probably FireWire 800. assuming you have, well, you definitely have that, assuming it still works, then I would suggest, you know, if you have any problems trying to do this over Ethernet, I would suggest, assuming the new machine has Thunderbolt, go to the Apple Store, get a Thunderbolt to, well, let's see, you're going to need two dongles.
FireWire 800. This is what I've got on the iMac right now. I was going to suggest, if you, like, Target Disk Mode.
But does it go FireWire 800 to USB 3 Thunderbolt, or does it have, do you have to adapt 2 to 3 and then 2 to 800?
I only have one adapter in the back of my 5K iMac. It's like FireWire 800 into this adapter and this adapter into the back of the iMac. But I confess I do not recall what exactly it's going into the back of the iMac.
So, you know, so assuming that you're... He doesn't actually say what he's going to, right?
No, I believe that's
okay,
correct.
Okay, so assuming that it's a current generation machine that only has Thunderbolt 3 ports, you might need two dongles to go once from 800 to Thunderbolt 2, and then once again from Thunderbolt 2 to Thunderbolt 3. So that might be like $80 worth of dongles, because Thunderbolt 1's like $50.
Yeah. We have to start considering Ethernet, because if they really do both have Ethernet ports, Ethernet is fast. And practically speaking, the reason I find myself using Ethernet is because I'm doing two desktops and they're far away from each other, and it's kind of a pain to like disconnect the desktop and lug it over and put it close enough so your little FireWire or Thunderbolt or USB-C cable can connect to the right ports. It's just... Then you're like, look, you know, Ethernet is easier. Even if your home isn't wired for Ethernet, to just get 100 feet of Ethernet cable and plug it in and snake it over and then leave it there for a day for you to do the transfers, that'll, of course, encourage you to wire your house for Ethernet like a civilized person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be, if they have a Mac Pro that doesn't have Wi-Fi, they probably have this covered.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, that I agree. Try Ethernet first and only go buy the $80 worth of dongles and cables if for some reason Ethernet always fails.
And back up before you do anything. Back up, make a bunch of backups, take the backups, disconnect them from all your computers, put it someplace else, and then have fun screwing with your computers. Because worst case scenario, you screw everything up, you erase everything, you restore from backup, and then you're back to your initial stage again.
Also, wait, if you can back up to like a USB 3 hard drive, your old Mac Pro doesn't have USB 3.
Migration.
But yeah, you could just then plug that into the new computer and just do it that way.
Oh, my word. All right. Bill Balinor writes, is it okay for developers to force polite interactions on their users, such as labeling the OK button in a prompt, yes, please, or the dismiss button in a confirmation dialogue, thanks. These things make me cranky. You're wrong. This is absolutely acceptable, and I like it.
Oh, God, no. What's wrong? Okay, so, there's if done in a non-intrusive, non-suggestive, not putting words in my mouth kind of way, it can be fine. Unfortunately, that's not what happens in practice. In practice, you have things like, no, I don't want to subscribe to the newsletter and get all these special deals because I'm cheap. Like, or like something like that. Like, they make you, so often, the words they use are passive-aggressively condemning yourself for making a choice that does not benefit the developer's business interests. And it's really obnoxious. Oftentimes, other than that, it just... You know, it tries to sound human and hip and cool, but it's from like a big corporation and we know that's fake. And it comes off as just insincere fakery trying to appeal to be more human from a company that is anything but. So it's very hard and very rare to get this kind of thing right in a way that sounds both sincere and non-offensive.
I think you're reading too much into this, or maybe I'm not reading enough into it. To me, like having a dismiss button that says thanks, I don't have a problem with that. Having a dismiss button that says no, I'm too cheap, or even if it's passive aggressively saying no, I'm too cheap, and not using those literal words, that, yes, I agree with you. That's total garbage. But something as simple as yes, please, or thanks, or no, thank you, like I don't have a problem with that at all.
I think you would have a problem with the thanks, because thanks is putting words in your mouth. Like you just want the box to go away. So there's two aspects of the problem. One is the giving your thing personality and putting words into the mouth of the user, because what if they're annoyed at your application right now and are forced to hit a button that says thanks and they don't want to thank your application at all because they're frustrated with your application? The thanks button makes them hate your application even more because you're forcing them to pretend they're saying thanks, right? But the second reason, independent of all this stuff, is people are accustomed to dialog boxes alerting a certain way. Yes, no, okay, cancel. Like there are interface standards that they're accustomed to, and if your application deviates from those standards in any way, there should be a reason for it. Maybe you're carrot weather and you have a personality type thing and that's part of the selling point of your application. Fine. But if your application is selling point is not like there's a cost to defying expectations. It causes people to pause and have to look at it and think about what they hit and like read. It causes them to have to read, whereas no one reads yes, no, or okay, cancel. If they see them a million times, they just, you know, it becomes like a visual macro. You're just like, oh, I recognize that and I know which thing I want to hit. Or even just a single button dismiss thing on iOS, where the button is always labeled as okay, and now suddenly that button has different text on it. You're forced to read it. You find out it says thanks. You don't feel like thanking anybody, and now you're annoyed. So I would in general say there is no 100% safe way to inject personality into labels like that. There are a lot of downsides, and the only potential upsides are if your application's value proposition is based on its personality and whimsy, which can be done, but is much trickier than you think.
It also, be very careful when you're writing dialogue text, if you're a developer or if you're Apple, that attributes malice or actions to the user, or if there attributes an intent or actions to the user that may or may not be the case. One of the most infuriating pieces of text on all of macOS is the dialogue that comes up after it has a kernel panic and shuts down and reboots that says, "You shut down your computer because of a problem." And a lot of times, no, you shut down my computer because of your problem.
It doesn't say that, does it?
It totally says that.
It says your computer shut down due to a problem.
It says,
right?
You shut down your computer.
Right, I got to Google for this now.
I agree with John. That is not how I remember this.
Are you sure?
I am not sure, but
I would check. Because I don't see it often. But every time I see it, I'm like, oh, I'm on fire. You shut down my computer. I didn't shut down my computer.
So here's what the kernel panic, you know, the overlay that comes on in five languages when you get a kernel panic?
Yeah, it's not that. It's the dialogue that shows up on the first boot after.
Right, okay. But so anyway, the overlay says, your computer restarted because of a problem. So that may be what I'm remembering for that wording, all right? Now, the after your computer restarts, Marco is right. I'm looking at this thing on Apple's website. It says, you shut down your computer because of a problem.
It sets me on fire if I ever see
it. It's right on Apple's website. We will put it in the show notes. I'm assuming this is the current dialogue, but it's an Apple support document.
It looks like it might be an old theme, but yeah, that's definitely the current wording.
Yeah, maybe I was reading it as your, because you know the kernel panic one does say your, but the dialogue after says you shut down. It doesn't even make sense. How would you shut down the computer like spontaneously because of a problem? Like, is it just like all of a sudden you saw a problem and you reached for the plug in the wall and yanked it out? Like, how is that even a thing that you could do? Because if you found a problem and you selected shutdown, you would never see this dialogue box.
You know, it's kind of like putting words in my mouth, but in this case, it's like putting actions in my mouth. It's like, no, I didn't do this. You know, you did this, you know, so when you're, you know, when you see an app that's like, you know, forcing you to say thanks or no, I don't want to see your great deals. I don't like great deals. Like, it's like that is, it seems like it might be cute or helpful or something. And trust me, it's not at all. Like you have to be so careful with that stuff that, you know.
And there is an additional dialogue, by the way, that says your computer was restarted because of a problem. And that one says the ignore more info and move to trash. For like an application that crashed, like we see that one when an app crashes. So there is one that is more, you know, less blamey. But the fact that there exists any dialogue that says you shut down your computer because of a problem, it's the dialogue that's asking whether you want it to restore all the applications that were open. So your choices are please reopen everything like it was before, or hit cancel to not reopen stuff. Which, by the way,
I'm sorry, what? Reopen everything? Please reopen everything?
Yeah, I'm not a dialogue box. I don't have to put that. Like, the button does not say, please open. Mm-hmm. The button says open, and the cancel button says no thanks, comma, cancel. Oh, I'm sorry. It doesn't say no thanks, comma, cancel. It says cancel, because that's what cancel buttons say. I don't know. I'm not a button. I'm a person. Yeah, that's what it's asking you. And so, again, if it's asking you that, it means the entire thing abruptly stopped functioning. And it realizes that it abruptly stopped functioning because it didn't do all like the nice shutdown cleanup stuff. So the next time it starts up, it says, I don't see the nice shutdown cleanup stuff, which means things ended abruptly last time. And I honestly don't think there's any user action that you could take other than if it knew somehow because of cameras that you had yanked the cord out or flicked the power switch, the hardware power switch yourself.
Even if it sees you do it, it still shouldn't say that. it's just setting you on fire unnecessarily.
And how would it know it was because of a problem? Maybe you shut down your computer because you couldn't figure out any other way to, like, you know, you're an inexperienced computer user, and the only way you know how to turn it off is to hold down the power button for 5 seconds.
Maybe you shut down your computer as a statement.
Yeah, because of a problem. It wasn't a problem with your computer. It was just, like, a problem in the world.
I think you might be reading too much into this. I think the way I've always read this and why I haven't been perturbed by it is because the computer, well, I guess it can turn itself off, but in this scenario of a kernel panic, it doesn't turn itself off. It is you that is physically turning the computer off and restarting it.
Not always.
So, no. Not in the case
of... In fact, by default, it reboots itself, doesn't it?
Does it reboot it? I didn't think it did.
I think it does now. I think that's been the case for the last few years.
Oh, no, you're right. You know, press a key or wait a few seconds to continue starting up. No, I guess you're right. All I know is you guys are clearly from the Northeast or have lived there too long because you're implied assholes. Moving on. Chad Zapursky.
Before you move on, I want to iterate. It's not about politeness. It's about the fact that there are conventions for the user interface. And anything that deviates from the convention, it's like, don't make me think. Like, anything that deviates from the convention requires thinking and processing time. And it's cognitive load for no benefit unless there is actual benefit of the personality of the application. Otherwise, every time we look at a dialogue, we'd have to parse each person's politeness and phrasing and preambles and stuff, and we just want okay, cancel, or we just want standard buttons that say standard things that fit in a standard amount of space, and we don't want to have to read them.
I actually do completely agree with you on that. Chad Zapursky writes, when it comes to video games, how much of a completionist do each of you consider yourselves to be? How much does it depend on the type of game, scope of the game, and your level of interest in it? I will start by saying I am not at all a completionist, and obviously I think Marco and I fight over who is the least video gamey person of the three of us, but I do play video games from time to time. As I think we mentioned last week, the week before, I've been getting back into Breath of the Wild. But there, whenever it is I beat Ganon at the end of Breath of the Wild, if I don't have all 120 whatever it is shrines, and if I don't have all 80 gazillion Kurok or whatever they're called seeds, I am not going to care. I will be putting that game down and probably never playing it again. And that's just me. Marco, since you are also useless like me, how do you treat this?
Kind of in between you and a normal person. I will try to be fairly complete as I'm playing, but then I will usually reach a point at which my interest just falls. For a game that can be, quote, beaten, or that has like a main storyline that can be completed, I do really want to complete that main storyline. But like you, once on my way there, I might be, collecting as much as I possibly can. Like when playing Mario Odyssey, I really try to get as many of the moons as possible, as I'm going through each world. I don't just fly away as soon as I can. But then after you complete the main storyline, you can go back and get a whole bunch more. And I started doing that, and I just haven't really continued yet. And I intend to go back and play it. I don't know when I will exactly, because now I'm playing other games now, so I don't know when I actually will. But I do intend to still go back and do that. I don't stop because I decide, oh, I'm done with this game forever. It just kind of happens. Like Stardew Valley. I played Stardew Valley very heavily for a long time. And I intend to go back to it, but the last time I played it was probably 3 months ago, and I just haven't gone back to it yet. But I do intend to. I haven't had a kid yet. I want to see how that works. So there's more I want to do in that game. But once I reach a certain point where I feel like I've done mostly everything there is to do, I find it hard to motivate myself to go back and get the last 10%.
Well, you did have an actual kid. What do you mean is a pixelated kid?
Yes.
All right. Just to make that clear. You're like, I haven't had a kid yet.
In Stardew Valley, the game I was talking about during that sentence.
It just seems context-free. Like, where's Adam?
He's upstairs asleep.
So this question doesn't really define what completionist means, but I'm kind of with Marco in that there's two strains. I like Marco if I'm playing a narrative game that is trying to tell me a story, and if I like the game well enough, that I'm having fun playing it, I do want to see how that story turns out. But the modern practice of video games of basically providing a tremendous amount of things to do outside the main story means that for me to actually 100% clear a game by getting all the things that you can get and doing all the things that you can do has actually become a lot harder over the years, both in terms of time investment and skill. It used to be that if you finish a story, then there'd be a couple of ancillary things to do. But Mario Odyssey is like, the story is like 1/8 of the game. And then like, if you really wanted to complete it in terms of hours spent and effort required, the real game begins after you finish the story mode. So I did finish the story mode of Mario Odyssey, and I did enjoy it. And I do like the fact that there's a lot more after that, and that you can do it kind of in any order that you want. But I don't think I will 100% clear Mario Odyssey ever. Contrast that with Mario Sunshine, which was not as good a Mario game by any stretch of the imagination as Odyssey, and yet I 100% cleared Sunshine, because the amount of stuff that you had to do beyond the main story in Sunshine seemed so much more tractable to me. And because the things they had you doing were like one annoying collection quest and a bunch of levels that were hard but of the variety that they'd already had that I really enjoyed. And so it seemed like a thing that I could do, and lo and behold, I did do it. Similarly with Zelda games, I will always finish a story in any Zelda game. I love Zelda games. I 100% cleared a couple of Zeldas, but not all of them, because some, especially as time goes on, when they start adding even more and more collectibles, like, I'm never going to get all the Korok seeds in Breath of the Wild. I won't. I just, it's never going to happen, right? But I probably will do eventually all the shrines. And that's a game that I love. If it's not a game that I love, I'll do the story and I feel like I'm done with it. What if the game has no story? If the game has no story, I'll just play it when it's fun, and when it stops being fun, I'll stop playing it. Like, I feel like I will actually continue to play a game after it stops being fun if I'm really close to the end of a narrative story, just because I want to see how it ends. That's kind of true like movies and books too. Sometimes you're like, well, I'm invested and I know there's only 3 chapters left, and even those books kind of annoying me, I still want to see how it ends, and so you'll power your way through. So that's kind of my take on completionism in video games.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Aftershocks, Backblaze, and Jamf Now. And we'll talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
Casey, you're back at work now.
Yeah, tell us about that. So you're full-time back now, right? Like, no, totally back to normal?
No. I'm spending the month of March easing my way in. So as we record this, last week I did a sum total of 1 day of work, and I did 2 half days, which basically means I went in when Declan was at preschool. And then this week I did a full day Tuesday, but only half of it at work. I did the rest from home, so you can guess where this is going. I went to work when Declan was at preschool, then I came home and was here working on my iMac for the remainder of the day. And then tomorrow, I am doing sort of kind of the same. We have an appointment to get Michaela's passport for some events that are happening in a couple of months that I believe I will be seeing both of you at. So we need to get that squared away. But this week I'm doing 2 days. Next week I'm doing 3 whole days. And I think the week after that I'm actually ramped up to full time. Now, I might be doing some of that from home here and there, which is not what I usually did. I usually pretty much only worked in the office. But it's week after next that I will be a real, real adult worker again. And it's going fine.
It's a pretty understanding job letting you ease back into it. I've never even heard of a company doing that.
This is the second time. Yeah, like the last time I took less time easing my way into it, and I also didn't take an unpaid leave, but they were fairly cool about it, both the last job and this job. So that's good.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I don't think I've ever had a job that would give me that. Usually, at most of my jobs, I had trouble like taking vacation days, like let alone well, like doing anything like this.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, I didn't as much ask as said this is what I was planning to do, and waited for somebody to say no, and nobody said no. And that's been nice. And I mean, the place I work, it's pretty. I was going to say chill, but I sound like a tool. I don't know. It's very relaxed, and it's, I think, in part because it's not consulting like most of the last few jobs I've had. There's a lot less urgency, and it's kind of okay if I'm gone. That being said, you know, I'm easing back in terms of hours worked. I am not easing back in terms of stress level and need for me to be paying attention to things again. The staff that I work with is excellent, but, or at least on the iOS side, but is very young, and that's not a bad thing at all. But that means that, they've kind of been queuing up a whole bunch of questions to ask, and how do I do this? What should we do here? What are we going to do about this other thing? And so I have been, in high demand in the little bit of time I've been working, which is a good problem.
Are they elementary school students? What the hell does very young mean when you're saying?
She started as an intern and is still in school and is part-time. So she is...
What major version of Pearl were they born during?
Are you at the stage now where anyone in their 20s counts as very young?
I'm getting there. I mean, my birthday's Saturday, for goodness sakes. I'm turning 36. I'm getting old, John. Getting old.
Hey, I'll be that old in a couple more months.
Yeah, I know.
So the 29-year-olds at work are very young.
No. One of the intern just turned 21 at the end of last year. So she was born in 96, I guess, which is bananas.
Oh, my God. She's younger than Weezer.
There you go. So the intern who is now part-time was born in 96, and we just hired a guy who I don't know how old he is, but I would guess 25 or less. So, and that's the whole staff is me and these two, well, the whole iOS staff that is. And so it's me and these, other two. So, and they're great. They really are great. And I'm really, really lucky to have them as my coworkers, but they're young, and that's not a bad thing. It's just, you know, there are things that you only get from being in the trenches in any sort of code base, be it iOS or otherwise, for a long time. And so, I am the old man in every measurable way, and that's just my life I need to adjust to.
So here's a question. Do you have anybody yet who is either so young or just so new to iOS programming that they have no Objective-C experience, that they only have Swift experience?
I'm trying to think if the part-time person did. I think she had done some Objective-C in the past, if I'm not mistaken, but it was a toss-up.
Because I almost wonder, like, that might make things easier, right? Like, if you try to maintain an all Swift code base or a mostly Swift code base, and you have somebody who doesn't have any mental baggage of Objective-C, that actually might be a good thing, right?
I don't know. I totally understand where you're coming from, and I'm not at all saying you're wrong. I really don't know, because it's one of those things like, do you really need to understand what a pointer is to be able to write code today? And I know you're both probably going to jump all over me, but like, if you think about it on a surface level, in a lot of cases, you don't really need to know what a pointer is. Now, I strongly believe that you do. So I'm like, I'm presenting an argument I don't actually believe in, but you could make an argument that, you know, you don't totally need a pointer to understand what the concept of a pointer is in order to be able to write Swift.
Yeah, I would totally argue that, actually.
Yeah, I still think it's important to understand what a pointer is. It's important to understand these sorts of things. And I think to some degree you get a lot more of that from Objective-C, and not only because you have stupid asterisks everywhere, but what I'm meandering toward is, I think having an understanding of what makes Objective-C Objective-C helps you understand what makes Cocoa and Cocoa Touch Cocoa into Cocoa Touch. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, I could see that. Although I would also suggest that in my time working around other programmers, I was fortunate enough that to usually work around really smart people, but not 100% of the time. and I was always sometimes really surprised how little somebody could know about programming and be working full time as a programmer.
Oh yeah.
And I think, and I'm not saying this to like say like, oh, they're so dumb, like that, just there are a lot of programming jobs out there that are pretty forgiving of having a very shallow understanding of it, or pretty forgiving of bad coding or mistakes or leaking memory or things like that. And iOS is a huge example of that. Like, you know, when the App Store was this huge explosion gold rush thing back, you know, 10 years ago, and you know, in the intervening years since, like, a lot of people learned Objective-C just enough to get an app out there and just like kind of stumbling through. And I mean, heck, that was basically me when I first started too. And I mean, I had a C background, so I knew that kind of stuff. But like, there's a lot of people who start knowing a lot less and can get an app in the store, because if they leak memory all over the place, it doesn't matter at the scale they are. Or like, you know, like if their app gets kicked out of the background because it crashes in the background, you don't even notice. You launch it again, and there it is. Like, you know, like,
especially
it's
then,
actually, yeah, it's actually a fairly forgiving environment. And the tools now protect you so much from doing things that are too horrible that you can actually get by pretty far without having knowledge of things like pointers and memory and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, and it's also, you know, to some degree, like what level are you hiring, right? Like when we hired our newest developer, you know, we were hiring somebody, we were intending to hire someone that was a bit junior. And so I don't recall how this went during his interview. I did interview him, but like I'm sure asked him, you know, what's a retain cycle? How do you create it? How would you accidentally create it? And, you know, how would you find it? And how would you fix it? And if I'm hiring a junior developer, they can get that wrong, and I potentially would be okay with it. Like, you know, I would hope that they would at least somewhat understand what I'm talking about, but they can have a wrong answer, and as long as they have a vague understanding and I feel like they're coachable, which is a very corporate thing to say. Exactly.
We can have a coaching opportunity in the parking lot after we stand up.
Right. So you have worked with me. but you see what I'm driving at? Like, I don't think that being, I'm agreeing with you in a roundabout way, you know, I don't think being super experienced and having a deep, deep, deep knowledge of like the history of Objective-C and why is message passing different than calling a method, you know, I don't think you need all of that, but I do fair enough, but I do think it is assistive in understanding, like I said earlier, you know, what makes Cocoa the way it is. It's because it's in large ways because of what made Objective-C what it is. And I don't think it's necessary. What is the thing? It's necessary but not sufficient. But I screwed that up, didn't I? Sufficient but not necessary. You get what I'm driving at.
That's it. Sufficient but not necessary. That's what Johnson always says.
Yeah, totally. So the point is that, you know, it's useful to have, but not required. John, you've been very quiet. Any thoughts about this?
I feel like this is a specific instance of the more general question of whether. Not whether you should have, but what the value is of having a background in the fundamentals when it comes to the everyday craft of doing a thing. Like, so can I do a particular task without knowing the history, cultural baggage, and all the other lower levels of abstraction that I'm building upon? And the answer is yes, you can. You can be a craftsman at a higher level of abstraction without detailed knowledge of history and culture and all the lower layers. But there is most certainly value in knowing all that stuff. I mean, you could take it just auto mechanic, right? There's lots of things that you can be trained to do to a car without knowing the details of the levels of abstraction that you're not dealing with, without knowing the history of internal combustion engines, particularly the history of the features of the internal combustion engines of a particular make of car. You don't need that background to be really good at doing the brakes, changing the oil, even disassembling and reassembling a particular model of engine. If you know how to do that at that level, you're fine, you know. But, you know, so getting back to computer programming, the question is, do I need a computer science background and a knowledge of algorithms, data structures, electrical engineering, circuit design, basics of electronics? Like, do you need to have all that to write an iOS app? Hell no, you do not. But having that background is valuable and makes you better at the job of writing an iOS application, particularly when, as inevitably happens, things go wrong and you have to figure out why they're going wrong. That's when whatever level of abstraction you're working at starts to fall apart and you find yourself looking at memory addresses in a debugger, assuming you even know enough to navigate a debugger. And if you don't know what a pointer is, it just feels like gibberish. You feel lost, right? But if you understand all those lower levels, you can drop down a level and drop down a level further. And if you're really good and know the whole stack and you're a Mike Ash type person, you can look at machine code and figure out what in the hell's going on, right? And even if you're not, though, even if you're not like someone who really can navigate the whole stack, just knowing how in general computers work from top to bottom lets you understand at least what parts you don't know and where you might go to look up something and to understand, I know what I'm looking at here. I just don't know specifically what it says, but I understand where it came from. And I understand if there's a part of it that I need to figure out, I know where to look for it. Or, you know, and all the way down to, like, hopefully none of us get down to the hardware level where you got to figure out what's wrong at the hardware level. But I still feel like even that, which probably won't come up in debugging a program, is useful to know because it explains many of the features higher up. Just as you were saying, knowing about Objective-C explains a lot of the weird features of Swift. Like, if you don't know about Objective-C, it may seem weird that Swift has these things, and what the hell does at obj-c mean, and why is that even there, and what do you mean by an object being backed by the Objective-C runtime versus one that isn't, and like, what is that, you know? You can get by without it, but there is most certainly value for it. And I think the question when people ask about this, whether it's should I have to know pointers or do I have to have a computer science background, is they want to know if it's like a gating factor. And I don't think it is. I think you can actually be a successful, good programmer. But I think all of that background that you're like, do I have to know this? There is value for it. And it's just a question of how much value does it have for the thing that you are doing. If you are working at Apple on frameworks, it's probably more important that you have that kind of background. If you're working at Apple on the compiler team, yet more important. If you are designing a hardware and software system from top to bottom, really, really important. So you just kind of have to decide how much of the background knowledge do I need to do my job well, and what is the cost of me acquiring that, both in terms of time and money.
I think you said something smart a minute ago with regard to it. It becomes important when things fall apart. You know, if in general, in my experience, like, I'm a relatively novice iOS developer. I mean, I've been doing it casually for a fairly long time, but I've only been doing it professionally for 2 years now. And it's when things fall apart that I start really getting stressed, and I have to start kind of reaching way outside my comfort zone, trying to figure out what is broken and why. And so I think in some ways, if I was a more experienced developer, I would get through these problems a lot quicker, more experienced iOS developer, I would get through some of these problems more quickly. But it's my experience in general as a developer, and in general, it's my experience of understanding most of the stack. And that's what keeps me, you know, kind of level headed. And that's what gives me the patience and tenacity to figure out a lot of these problems. And I wish I had a specific example offhand, and I don't, which is good, I guess, because that means things haven't violently died recently. But, but, you know, I do think it's valuable that I have not only a CS background, but a computer engineering background, which to me is a combination of CS and electrical engineering. And I'm sure a lot of people will take offense at that. I don't care. That's just the way I look at it. And that means, you know, where CS, from my experience, and I'm not trying to say this is fact, this is just the way I look at it, CS tends to stop with code, usually, or maybe memory, whereas computer engineering goes all the way down to logic gates. And that isn't helpful in a day-to-day time, but it is helpful, just like John said a minute ago, it's helpful to understand what, at least vaguely, what are all these abstractions and how do they relate to each other?
It demystifies it. Like, you know, I don't know the details of how anything works, but I know how a CPU works, and I have built a CPU from the logic level up, and I have built a logic gate with a solid state electrical components, and, you know, like that whole thing. It doesn't mean suddenly you know how your computer works, but there's no more magic. Like, you know, from top to bottom, you know, the magic starts basically at the quantum level where my physics courses ran out. Like, that's where the magic starts, and that's pretty low. That's pretty low down. Everything else is like, I'm not scared of it. It doesn't seem magical. The other thing I forgot to mention about having a background in the fundamentals is it also gates how high you can go. So if you want to make an iOS application, chances are good that you won't need any sort of in-depth knowledge about data structures and, you know, fundamental computer science-y algorithms or even things like neural networks and stuff like that, because the frameworks do a lot for you, and probably your application is not as complicated as you think it is. Like, probably it's just a fairly basic application, right? But if you are building a more complicated application, games are a great example because they employ a lot of things where you know, the first approach that occurs to you is terrible and won't work well. That's the time where you're like, if I had a background in computer science, I might know some algorithms that would do this in a more efficient way. If you don't have a background in that, very often you will find, like, you'll find yourself deriving from first principles a sort of half-assed version of a well-known algorithm Like you know, I'm not saying you can figure it out yourself, but it's like you're wasting your own time. If you had just had a background in data structures and algorithms, you would have immediately narrowed down to a couple of choices and maybe recalled off the top of your head the big O notation for all these different things and known which one works best and then just, you know, found, you know, implemented that yourself. Most of the time, again, most of the time you don't have to do this. Most of the time libraries implement these things for you. If you have some sort of associative array or dictionary or hash structure or NS array under the covers is doing all sorts of smart things with all sorts of smarter algorithms, switching from hash buckets to a linear search when the size dictates that it's smart. Like, you don't even have to know about that. The magic happens behind the scenes for you. But if you are building a structure like that yourself to manage your own data, again, maybe in games where efficiency is paramount, it really, really helps to have that background knowledge. So not just figuring out the lower layers above you, but being able to do for yourself the things that for most developers are done for them by the frameworks and the OS and everything does give you the ability to do more complicated things. And if you don't have that background, you can still do it, but you will essentially be figuring out things that people figured out tens or hundreds of years ago as you derive from first principles, basic mathematical concepts and data structures, which works fine, but it takes more time.
There is a truly phenomenal series of YouTube videos that PBS made in association with, I think, a few other groups. It's called Crash Course Computer Science. And Mike and I talked about this a little bit on Analog, and we were trying to do like a, you know, we'll watch one each week. And it turns out that it's not very entertaining as a podcast, but I cannot recommend enough watching this series. There's 40 videos, of which each of them is like 10 to 15 minutes. And it brings you from the abacus all the way to modern computing. And I've only watched the first maybe quarter of them, but it is step by step going from an abacus all the way up to cloud computing and machine learning and stuff like that. And what you learn by watching these, even if you don't totally understand the ins and outs of what they're talking about, the thing that I think is most important that you can glean from these videos is that everything is just one abstraction on top of another, and it's abstractions all the way down. And it is impressive and fascinating to see this broken out in 40 different chunks, little bite-sized pieces. And you see, like, especially once you get into like how memory actually works and how, you know, these logic gates are held together or put together, I should say, in order to make memory. Even I sort of kind of have my eyes glaze over a little bit, but the point that that you get from this isn't necessarily that, oh, you need, you know, 13 NAND gates or whatever in order to, you know, store 8 bytes of data. And I'm obviously making this all up, but the point is just that, oh, you take a bunch of transistors, hook them up, that makes gates. You take a bunch of gates, hook them up, that makes memory. You take a bunch of memory, hook it up, that makes a whole, you know, wad or block of memory. And it's just, you build upon what happened before you. So if you happen to have roughly 400 to 500 minutes to spare, I cannot recommend Crash Course Computer Science enough, and we'll put a link in the show notes.
Well, I'm behind on Analog, so you and Mike just bailed on that?
Yeah, we did.
I knew that already.
That's disappointing. I was excited for that series.
I was too. I couldn't get him to get into it. I tried. And I don't blame him. Like, the problem, I think he enjoyed it to some degree, but there isn't a lot for us to say about it because there's little interpretation involved, right? And that's the bummer behind it. But I hope that he won't, but I hope that he watches it.
He's just not that into computers.
Well, he uses a fake computer all the time. What do you expect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you make him a video series called How iPads Work? And maybe that would work better.
Yeah, it's just, you open it up and it's just a bunch of unicorns and elves dancing around.
Well, just two at a time, one maybe hovering over.